It is a beautiful night out tonight. A little bit cold. It was definitely a two-scarf walk to work. I mean, last night when I was walking home, I thought, wow, I wish I had another scarf. I need one for around my neck and one for around my face. So I did that tonight. Much better on my walk to work. I'm Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith is in Florida. He got there about noontime today. He said the kids were acting fabulously. They're all excited for their holiday vacation down there. They will be gone until 2014. So this is our last live program until then. Coming up are encore performances of the People's Tour across America and for America and with America and of America and all the prepositional Americas. It was quite a trip. It was pretty amazing. I don't know quite yet what the details are for the book coming out, but the book's, you know, the ink is drying on it as we speak. It's pretty exciting that the book will be out. There are chapters that deal with kind of moderate historical events that had to do with the growth of the middle class, with organizing in the workplace, labor unions, union busting, lockouts, strikes, scabs, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's really just a pretty, pretty, I'd say maybe 10, no, not that much, 5% of the U.S. history snapshots of labor reality. Probably not even that much, because there's so much that happened in the history of the United States and so little has been reported on it. But we really tried to hit some of the important places, and then there are a lot of current events in there. I mean, for example, when we were in New York, we went to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire location, which is now an NYU New York University lab. That building has been turned into a lab. It was only three floors, really. The top floor, the 10th floor, were the offices for the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, but the 8th and 9th floor, the factory. And that is now a biology laboratory for New York University. And we were there to see where the fire took place, where so many 146 wonderful, vibrant young people died in that fire. Many fell to their deaths. As the fire, you know, just wiped out those floors. And we were there. It was the site of a union busting thing, the NYU private university that actually had a labor union for its graduate students. The union got busted. And I think it's my understanding now that the union's back in place. Is that what I heard? Yeah, there's Brett screaming down the hallway. We're in this weird situation. We've moved our location. We're back in Carlisle now. We're in this brand-new, beautiful studio that's been built here. It's really styling. I mean, I put a picture up on Facebook. All-new facility, but Brett and I can't see each other, which was probably Brett's Christmas present this year. But so he's down the hall, and we just scream at each other, so... There's that. Anyway, so part of this building of the middle class, or as one of the guys we interviewed in California said, the history of how the middle class built itself, which I thought was really a cool way to put it. Today, there's an interesting poll out. Most Americans think that the government should take action to address the wealth gap. Finally! You know, the government needs to get in there and do something. I love government. I wish we had one. According to a Washington Post ABC News poll that was released today, 64% now, two-thirds almost, just a fraction away from two-thirds, say federal policy today does pretty much very little to help the poor, and 64% say federal policies do more to favor wealthy Americans. Only 26% of people in the United States think that any federal policies help the less fortunate. 57% say it's time for the government to pursue policies that would reduce the gap between the wealthy and the less well-off. 57% say it's time for them to do something, but this is an interesting statistic. 66% of them want the minimum wage raised. 66%. So 57% think that the government needs to do something. 66% want to see the minimum wage raised. Don't they realize that it's the government that raises the minimum wage? Anyway, 66%. Guess how much they want it raised to? 66% want it raised to $10.25 an hour. I'm impressed. That's a $3 an hour raise. That's not enough. It's like $15 is a living wage. But are you kidding me if you're a person right now who works 35 hours a week and you could make another $3 an hour? You'd be making another $105 a week. And considering you're only making about $250, that's a lot of money. I think that's fabulous. It's about time that the American people started saying something like that needed to be fair. And it needed to be done. And it does need to be done. And, of course, tonight at 10 o'clock, we're going to have Professor Feiner on, who's going to talk about the economics of our economics. And we'll ask her about the minimum wage. We're also going to ask her about the fact that the Federal Reserve has decided to, what was the word that you used? Trimming? Is that what you said? The Federal Reserve is going to take $10 billion back out of the economy. It's just not going to print as much money. And, you know, you got to throw dollars all away all the time because they get burned or torn up or covered with coke or bloody or whatever happens to money so that money can't be used anymore. And they're going to trim this $10 billion out of the economy of the stimulus money that was just sort of flooded into there. We're going to ask the professor what that means. I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me for just a second. Maybe not. excuse me. I did. And then, of course, there's the whole notion that the budget being passed by the Senate now, it's on its way to the president, it's going to get signed. I want to know, is Paul Ryan having a party over that? What did happen to Social Security? I want to know that, too. So we'll ask the professor those questions. We're going to find out about what's going on real locally. We're going to talk a little bit to Ed Bottlespot tonight about Safe Harbor. Of course, Safe Harbor Homeless Shelter, Cumberland County's largest homeless shelter, located right on High Street in Carlisle. They've got a lot going on right now. This is their annual campaign. And Ed's going to talk to us about that, as well as what's going on for the holidays in downtown Carlisle. I went shopping myself today because pretty much everybody I care about and have to send presents to is away. So I had to get my packages ready for the post office. Oh, my God, that place was crowded. The post office at Carlisle is always crowded, and I'm thinking it has to be because we have so many people that come here from away, you know, with the Army War College and with Dickinson and with all the other things that go on here. There's just a lot of probably mail that goes back and forth because people aren't, you know, local. But, oh, the holiday season, and everybody was in a great mood. People were talking to each other and being nice to each other, and the postal employees were their usual wonderful selves. I love the post office. Susan Collins, a friend of mine, actually, a woman I've known for a long time. We used to work together at Husson University. She and Lieberman, the biggest waste of skin invented, they have rigged it so that people would think that the post office was in trouble. The post office is not in trouble. The post office has been bankrolling money. They have been bankrolling 75 years worth of retirement benefits and health care benefits for their employees. No other branch of the government has to do that. By the way, the post office doesn't depend on tax dollars, not a dime of tax dollars, not a penny of tax dollars, not $1 million, not nothing. The post office completely operates on money that it takes in for services, for the product it delivers, literally, for everything the post office does for you. That's how the post office survives, invented by Benjamin Franklin. And here it is, this incredible functioning system. I put a stamp on a letter, and 2 days later, it's in San Diego at the right address. When my son was in the Peace Corps and he was in Mongolia, he never didn't get a package. Every single package I sent to him through the United States Postal Service, and they were the only people who would ship there, got there fine. So, you know, this whole the post office is failing is just a pile of garbage, and it's the reason that they're saying that, the reason they're telling these lies about the post office, the reason that they have forced the post office to put 75 years worth of retirement and health care benefits away. They don't do that to the Department of the Military or any of that other stuff, is so that they can say it's failing and they can privatize it. And then whoever buys it is going to have that huge, huge swollen abscess of cash that they've been forced to put away. And it's so that it can be privatized, and they can say it's not working, and then they can say private industry could do a better job, and that's all a pile of bunk. And all you have to do is talk to the really wonderful men and women that are letter carriers or working at the staffing the offices, staffing the or have a problem with the post office. They're wonderful. You can track every package you send now. And I purchase quite a bit online. It is all coming via the United States Postal Service because these big companies know that the post office works great too. So anyway. That's my rant about the United States Postal Service. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take your calls tonight, too, so get the number, get a pen, write it down. It's 888-520-7425, 888-520-RICK, 520-RICK. I'm Pat. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Region 1C Director Norwood Jewell says the United Auto Workers Union wants to end the two-tier wage system at the Detroit 3. That system pays some new hires much less than veteran UAW members at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. Jewell told reporters in Flint, Michigan that the UAW hates the two-tier system and will work to get rid of it. New hires under the two-tier system now hire in at just under $16 an hour. That wage can rise to $19 over time, while veteran UAW members make about $28 an hour. Roughly 16% of GM's 51,000 UAW members make that lower wage. At Ford, it's about 19%, and at Chrysler, it's close to 25%. The UAW will be in contract talks with the Detroit 3 in 2015. Nancy Becker is an American working for Amazon in Germany. She traveled to Seattle recently to dare Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to try working as a picker in an Amazon warehouse for just a single week. She doesn't think he could survive it because the work is physically demanding and wages are low. These workers known as pickers pick out the merchandise ordered by Amazon customers for shipment. Amazon workers in Germany have been striking over the low pay and working conditions. Nancy Becker came to Seattle, Amazon's world headquarters, to participate in rallies driving home the point that while Bezos, other executives, and Amazon shareholders are getting rich, Amazon workers are suffering. Becker says the Amazon system is characterized by low wages and permanent performance pressures. The National Institute on Retirement Security says blacks and Latinos in the United States own shockingly little assets for their retirements. In a recent report, the Institute says 62% of black American workers and 69% of Latino workers own no assets in retirement accounts. The report also notes that 3 out of 4 black households and 4 out of 5 Latino households, ages 25 to 64, have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. 1 out of 2 white households have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. In a different study, the Economic Policy Institute found that the American retirement system simply doesn't work for most workers and underscores the importance of preserving and strengthening Social Security and also defending the remaining defined benefit private pensions.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. We deserve more. We're worth more.
McDonald's is making $5.5 billion off of profits last year. Arby's made $1.5 billion off of profits last year. So why are we getting all these low minimum wage jobs? We sit up in a poor neighborhood trying to survive. Enough is enough. We're tired. It's time to rise up.
Keep the voices of workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day. Support Workers Independent News right now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
A great game of rocks in the hot sun. I hope the law and the law won. I hope the law and the law won.
I love the music you used for Ed Bidlespa. Breaking rocks in the hot sun. Pat LaMarcia filling in for Rick Smith. Rick Smith is off. I guess maybe that's a good one for him. He's down there in Hollywood, Florida with the family, with my family. That's where my father lives. I wonder if he'll run into him. And he will be back in 2014, so he said, to wish you all a very happy new year, wonderful holiday. And in the meantime, a lot of stuff happens this time of year. One of the things people do is they kind of prepare themselves to have a chat sometime in the first quarter of next year with their good friends at the IRS. And if they make certain contributions prior to the end of the year, why, that can figure in favorably for them in that chat with the IRS when they file their forms. And the great folks at Safe Harbor Homeless Shelter on High Street in Carlisle have an idea for what you can do with that money, don't they, Ed Bidlespa?
Yes, they do. they can contribute largely to Safe Harbor.
Yeah. Now, Ed, you are the president of the board of directors of Safe Harbor?
I am.
Okay. And you've been on there for 3 or 4 years or something now, right?
Yeah, probably since you brought me on back when a long time ago.
Yeah, in the interest of full disclosure, I used to be the vice president over there at Safe Harbor. And I love the place and I love the people. And, in fact, I saw a young woman, she's actually an older woman today, ran into her downtown, who's one of the most fragile human beings I've ever met. And she was in the shelter at a Christmas time about 3 or 4 years ago. And she was a single woman. I don't want to call her elderly, but she's old enough to have all of her kids grown and gone and grandchildren that are grown up. And she works pretty much as full-time as a fast food place will let her. She works at a fast food place in Carlisle. And she walks there and walks home. And she works four
maybe
or five.
Maybe we could call her Season.
Color season?
Yeah, color seasoned instead of elderly.
Seasoned. Yeah, well, she's quite seasoned. And so she works there cleaning the parking lot or cleaning the lobby. That's her job. And it was Christmas time, and you know how all you guys that are on the board would say, you know, get us the individuals that don't have anything, because people always want to bring presents to the children. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times older residents are forgotten. And so I asked her what she would like for Christmas. And she started to cry. And I didn't know her very well at this point. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, I've wanted for about 5 years, all I've wanted is a tombstone for my daughter's grave.
I remember this.
Yeah. And she had been, minimum wage employees don't just all of a sudden become minimum wage employees. They pretty much earn minimum wage their whole lives. And her daughter had fought leukemia for 10 years. And this whole family survived this struggle until the daughter died. And then it just broke the bank. And we raised the money. And she got her stone for her daughter. And one of my favorite parts of that story was, I think we had $750 or something to buy a stone. And so the guy came, he made a house call to Safe Harbor to meet her, and she kept wanting all these elaborate things, you know, a picture on the stone and 5,000 letters in the inscription, and, you know, and I kept saying, you know, you've got to cut that back, because, you know, people, that's expensive. And he kept saying to me, don't tell her that. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And she ended up getting like a $2,000 stone for $750 because he was so wonderful,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I remember that. I can't remember her name either, but I do remember the circumstance.
Yeah, and so those are the things. Those are if there are 100 people in there tonight, then there are 100 stories like that of individuals who just for one reason or another. And here this woman was working at least 5 days a week. She just was only working about 5 hours a day at $7 an hour, $6 an hour, something back then. So what is it that keeps you? I mean, you are the busiest guy in Cumberland County. What is it that keeps you working so hard for Safe Harbor?
I just believe in the mission, and I'm just trying to make it a better place for people that are less fortunate than the rest of us. We all have so much and have so much to be thankful for, and then there's those people out there that are at the other end of the spectrum, and I think they deserve the dignity that they're due, and we just try to us and the other board members on our board try to make sure that they have a nice holiday and a good place to stay and warm food and clothes and everything that the rest of us just take for granted.
Right. And Safe Harbor does a better job. I've been in an awful lot of homeless shelters. Safe Harbor does a better job than 99% of them. You know, as far as all that privacy.
As you well know, we're one of the few that serves families and keeps families together as a unit. And so break up the family unit. We try to keep everybody together as much as possible. And your comment a little bit earlier that we have 82, right now there's 82 people in residence at Safe Harbor, 11 families, and there's 30 children.
Wow.
Ranging 6 months to 15 years of age.
Yeah, there's nothing like a homeless baby. Six-month-old baby, you know. Well, in that point you made about keeping the family intact, that's very rare. Most shelters, the other shelters in one other shelter in Carlisle doesn't allow children at all. And then the other shelter that does allow children doesn't allow children over the age of 12. So if you've got a 13-year-old and a 5-year-old, you can't go into a shelter unless you're willing to give your 13-year-old away.
That's correct.
Really tough. No husbands, no uncles, no single dads. There's no single dad shelter except for Safe Harbor. So it's really, and that's not to pick on all those other shelters. Nobody does in this country. There's a place in Detroit. There's a place in called Umam in Phoenix. I mean, that's how rare it is. I can count them off on my fingers, you know.
We're probably one of the best secrets in Pennsylvania, for that matter, of let alone the rest of the country. But, yeah, we don't break up the family unit. We try to keep them together and it's really important to our director, Ms. Wendell. You know Wendell Hollinger. So that's kind of the thing that we keep in the forefront of our minds, keep that going.
Right. So, but this is a pretty important campaign. This is, they only do one campaign, unlike other charities that will do a letter-writing campaign every month. They do one letter once a year, and it raises anywhere from a third to a half of the cash that needs to be raised in the area. And F&M Trust, you're at the bank where you are assistant vice president?
Yeah.
Yeah. F&M Trust takes a huge role in that letter, in that annual drive. Can you tell us what you're doing this year?
Well, this year our president and CEO of F&M, Mr. Bill Snell, has sent the letter out again that's forwarded by Safe Harbor to residents and stakeholders in the area. That we're trying to raise, we have a goal this year of $62,000. And I believe as of, here about a couple days ago, we have raised in $45,000 in cash in pledges.
Wow.
The campaign runs till January 22nd or something like that. And, we have baskets in all our branches in Cumberland County of F&M Trust where people can donate clothes for the children and people that live at Safe Harbor that are without. And we also are able to take donations at the branches for people who want to donate cash or money instead of clothing. So they can do that right at the branch as well.
So if someone comes in there to cash their $5,000 holiday check that they got from their dad, they can turn around and say, hey, put 50 of that in the Safe Harbor account for me, would you?
That's correct. They can do that. The teller is able to do that and generate a receipt for that person so that they have it for their records as well.
And you can also do it if you only have $5 because it all gets put together.
That's correct. That's correct. They can do it with a dollar if they want to. We'll take donations of any size.
So can someone do that who isn't an F&M customer? Could someone just walk into one of your branches and say, hey, I heard what you're doing for Safe Harbor and I want to give you $10?
Yes, anybody can do that.
That's great. It's like having a remote location all over. This is the Cumberland County branches?
Yes, everything from Campville to Shippensburg, F&M Trust, and there's offices in Campville, Mechanicsburg, Carlisle, obviously, and as far as Newville and Shippensburg.
Wow, that's great. And this is something new you're doing this year. Other years you've taken baby food and diapers, but this year you're asking for children's clothing.
That's correct. Other years we've raised food. I believe back when you were there, we did a diaper campaign, and we collected diapers for all the infants that were there because, once again, the families came there practically with nothing, and we raised a lot of diapers for folks that year. This year we're doing the clothes for children, which There are other charities in the area that will collect and donate clothes, but I don't know how much of it stays there, where all the clothes that are donated to Safe Harbor actually stay at Safe Harbor.
Yeah. I think that year that we did diapers, it was because we had 6 babies under 6 months.
Yeah,
you know,
I know, just the way
it shook out that Christmas, we just had so many babies in the building, and it was like, oh, my gosh, you know? And that's a need all year round.
It is.
Those paper products or hygiene products or anything that, that you can think of that you still use when it's, you know, July, they need there. It's just that people are so much more keyed into to giving at this time of the year.
Yeah, they're more aware of it and how important it is to other people because it's kind of out there in everybody's face all the time. So they do more this time of year than other years. But to your point also, this is the only campaign like this that we do each year. So and it sustains a lot of families for a long period of time. I think if I remember right, when we did the diaper drive, didn't that keep those people in diapers for like up until March or April?
Yeah, it was up until springtime.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is $62,000 when I was there, which is not that long ago really, 2011, it was about $65 a night to keep a family at Safe Harbor. And when you think of everything that's paid for, you know, obviously heat, water, all that stuff, mortgages, but on top of that, 24-hour security, case management, all the needs, a family is $65, or let's say $62 a day, just to do the math with your $62,000 goal. That means 1,000 days. That's 1,000 days of taking care of a family. And obviously,
well,
one family wouldn't be all 1,000 days, but I mean, that's a long time that Safe Harbor will be able to care for families.
And our annual operating budget each year is somewhere close to $650,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, understand that's everything. That's administrative costs, salaries, maintenance, repairs, everything that we do. But of that money, that $62,000 that we raised goes a long way into keeping people there and providing housing and food for all those folks.
Right. And you do have some permanent housing. You have properties in Mechanicsburg and in Carlisle where a lot of elderly stay. And, you know, and if you're an elderly person making $600 for your Social Security benefit, you're not staying really anywhere else in Carlisle.
Well, that's right. And as you know, we have three types of. We have the emergency shelter where people come in on an emergency basis. Then we have the transitional housing, if you remember. Then we also have the supportive permanent housing where people, as you're mentioning there, that they can move into that housing where they can stay there permanently and live on a very limited income because we don't take them all their money. We just take what we need. So
yeah.
It's not a case where they're spending all their money just to have a roof over their head. That's not the case. That's not our mission.
Right, which is just so common. I mean, unless you have a family to live with, which a lot of people don't. That whole safety net social fabric thing has really eroded for a lot of people. And it's great that Safe Harbor's been there.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know what it is or why it is, but it seems as though families, especially if somebody has special needs people in their family, they don't have the time for them. You know, we have, on any given day, we have about 80 to 115 persons go through Safe Harbor. So that's 38,000 shelter nights in a year's time. That's a lot. You know?
Wow. Wow. Hey, Ed, our time goes too quickly when I get a chance to talk to you.
Well, it was good talking to you.
Thank you. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say thank you for everything you're doing for Safe Harbor and for Carlisle and for Cumberland County and the community. And you're just a wonderful guy, and I just appreciate the fact that I know you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all you've done for the homeless, too. You've been a big mouthpiece out there for the homeless and advocating all the work that needs to be done in that regard. So thank you for your support. Thank you for all that you've done. And I know I'll be talking to you again in the near future.
Yeah, and if it's not real soon, Merry Christmas.
Same to you. Have a good day. Tell Chad I said hello.
I will. I will. I'll pass that on. That's Ed Vitalspa, the assistant vice president over at F&M Trust, and they're doing great things for Safe Harbor, as they do every year at this time of year. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be right back.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats, specifically by an Inside the Beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout, only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You'll see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Yeah, it's the fast lane. What are you doing with it? This is the Brett Benatelli have fun on our last live night of 2013. It is, you know, so the fast lane. I was in New York City about a month ago doing one of my trips around the country talking about poverty and homelessness. And I got a chance to meet Clifford Thompson, and I just was really impressed. The guy's an author. He's got this really cool blog. Cliff, what is it, tellcliff.com?
Tellcliff.com, yes.
And Cliff, you're when someone meets you, they don't say, hey, I bet this guy just won a whole slug of writing awards. You know? I mean, you're kind of unassuming, and I will say you do use the English language beautifully.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Did you always want to be a writer?
Not always. In a way I did. I actually, when I was young, wanted more than anything in the world to be a comic book artist.
Oh.
So I wrote and illustrated my own superhero comic book when I was a teenager.
What was who was your superhero?
He was called the Telstar.
Telstar.
It was called the Telstar because his superpowers corresponded to the Telstar satellite, so he could fly, and the crowning thing of this was that he had what was called a telepunch, meaning that he could swing his arm on one side of the room and the punch would be felt by a criminal on the other side of the room. Yeah, that was my big
nice. So he was kind of teleporting his punch.
Exactly.
And right. Now you've got TellCliff.com. Did you notice that?
TellCliff.com, exactly.
You use right. this tell thing.
Yeah, it's been kind of a motif in my life.
you know, the other thing I like letters and I like words, because I guess writers are like that anyway, right?
Yeah.
But I like TellCliff because you've got all these tall letters. The T, the L's, the F, you know, and the F's, and then you've got... It's just pretty.
I never thought about that, but you're right. That's true.
All lowercase, of course, and
right.
Neat looking. Okay, so I would tell people what you've done, but there's too much of it. And you're like 30, right?
No, actually, I'm 50.
No, get out of town.
Yeah, no, it's true. No,
that's your superhero power. Yet. You didn't age.
No, it's true. I have a daughter in college. I have one in high school. I'm not in the first flush of youth, put it that way.
Well, I am impressed by how young you look, but I'm not so impressed by your long resume anymore. I thought you crammed this all into like 20 minutes.
No, sorry to disappoint you.
No, it's okay. I'm not terribly disappointed. I can go back to the awards.
Okay.
Before I do, though, your novel, Signifying Nothing, is that based on the Shakespearean quote?
It is, actually. The title has two, means two things, or at least two things. So it's from Macbeth, but, signifying also in black culture signifies just a way of communicating, but playing the dozen. You're talking about yourself, talking about other people, signifying.
That's neat.
It's sort of a double meaning. And the character, it's about a family. It's set in the 70s, and it's about a family. And the youngest child in the family is 19. He is mentally handicapped and has been mute his entire life until one day he suddenly begins rapping because at the top of his lungs because of what turns out to be a rare neurological condition. So it's really about the rest of the family and the effect that this has on the rest of the family and their relationship.
Now, you said a sentence that I really liked that I'd like to focus on a little. You said in the black culture.
Yeah.
We don't ever, now, being a white person, I might mean we white people. Unfortunately, the vast majority of which don't know there's a difference. You know, don't know that they've got it easier, don't know that they've got a, don't understand their privilege at all. But I don't think I ever hear anyone refer to black culture as cultural. You know what I mean? I mean it.
Well, it's you can. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you can as a black American be made to feel that you are sort of culturally homeless.
Mm.
If I can use that term because you're cut off from Africa, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the culture there because you live in the United States. At the same time, the country that you live in has traditionally treated people like you, pretty reprehensibly. So it can feel, you can feel both cut off from Africa and it can feel like almost like self-hatred to embrace this country that you live in but that has traditionally rejected you until you realize that this country, if you're a black American, this country is as much yours as it is anybody else's, because, well, for a number of reasons, for one thing, the Southern economy pretty much rested on your back.
Right.
And also, just the cultural contributions of black Americans to this country is so central. I mean, we've basically, black people gave this country its indigenous music, among other things.
Uh-huh.
So that when you realize this, you realize that you can take pride in calling yourself an American and being part of the American family, and which, in my case, gave me a sort of cultural grounding that allowed me to then feel comfortable exploring. Other culture, which is what I've tried to do in my book, you know, whether I'm talking about books or film or jazz or art.
Well, there must be a cultural overlap to folks with handicaps. You know, it's interesting that you wrote about that, you know, this kid's got a handicap, and because, you know, anyone who's worked with poverty works with a lot of different, what is seen as disadvantages. You know, what is perceived by someone who doesn't have to struggle as something that would not enrich your life, would only diminish it. And yet, and then when you roll around with these people who have issues that have challenged them, and you learn the power that they've exerted over them, you also see a cultural, I think that forms a cultural bond and...
Yes, definitely. I mean, it, you know, there is something in the very nature of having to struggle that becomes part of your culture. You know, I'm a big jazz fan, and you know, if you're in a position culturally where you have to struggle to get ahead, you sort of you improvise, you do things in ways that haven't been done before because those are the only ways that are open to you. And what I discovered was that the musical equivalent of that is a Black American invention, basically, which is jazz, which involves improvisation, which is one reason that, you know, jazz is such a cultural touchstone for me, and I relate it to a lot of things, to a lot of other things that I write about.
I think my first exposure to jazz, of all places, was in Canada, in Montreal. My first real exposure to it. And you just don't think of jazz and freezing every exposed part of your body off.
It's the same.
Yeah, really. But I was up there for a Winter Carnival, and jazz is the music of the Winter Carnival, really.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, it's, and a lot of that is because of a lot of people. First of all, a lot of people from the South who were people of color fled to Canada. But then also a lot of the French who were at times oppressed after the United States started pushing west also moved up there. So it's very interesting. You know, I've had all these, it seems like in the last two or three days, I've had to have an awful lot of discussions, arguments, fights, for want of a better term, about race. In my personal life, on Facebook and in all the social media that we're using now, it seems as though, and that was one of the reasons I called you to come and talk to me, us, the us out there on Radio Land. It seems to me that there is such a desire to dismiss any prolonged suffering. Yeah. Well, no, okay, it's over now.
Right.
You know, everything from the voting rights issues to everything, it's over now. Will you drop it? And no, I'm not going to drop it. And you know what? I might put Trayvon Martin back up as my Facebook picture because I am really sick of you. You know, so I just keep, you know.
Yeah.
So arm me. Tell me what I need to say. I think it's our job. Although I don't know, my mother was an Irish immigrant, right?
Yeah.
So my mother was in the early 70s. I lived in Providence, Rhode Island, and they kept shutting our schools down because of busing. They were trying to. You're old enough to know. I think you were too young. So my mother would go out and fight, you know, protest, fight like crazy for this integration and this, you know, and she was so angry because I think she knew what it felt like to some degree, even though she had an advantage in the fact that she was white. she had great disadvantage in the fact that, you know, her whole family had, you know, they weren't citizens at first, you know, all those other things that they had to live through.
But
I just really think it's our job as a whole pile of white people know better to keep fighting. So I want you to tell me how to do that in five minutes.
I was just thinking about a woman whose work I came in contact with just in the course of my daily work. Her name is Maya Wiley, and she's an anti-poverty activist. And she had a really interesting, take on things. Part of which is that when people talk about the effect of, the ongoing negative effect of race and racism, often what people have in mind is just you know, these sort of bull kind of like bigots, and when part of the time it's not even so much about conscious racism as it is about just the sort of lingering effects of racism that people perpetuate without even really thinking about it. For example, Maya Wiley cited a study in which it came to light that if two people send in a resume for the same, be considered for the same job, if one person has a black sounding name for lack of a better term, that person will have a harder time getting the call for the job because even for the interview. And it's not necessarily a conscious decision on the part of the person who is doing the interviewing. It's just, it just like triggers something almost in their unconscious mind.
Right.
Seemingly. So there's a lot of, there's just a lot of residual effects that are not the result of conscious racism. But so it's just something, it's a thing to be aware of. I think that would go a long way toward addressing the problem if people just sort of recognize that they may be unconsciously perpetuating the situation.
Well, I think that's really a good point. One of the arguments I had, or I hate to use things like that because I always try to refer to them as discussions, though, but, Paula Deen is now getting these accolades for losing 30 pounds.
Right.
I want to lose 180 pounds of Paula Deen. I want her,
I'm with you there.
It's just a start, Paula. It's just, I want her to fade into obscurity completely and forever.
Right.
She did a comeback and that was came out on a stage in Texas and got a standing ovation.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. So I basically said, I don't care about this woman. I want her to vanish. And she's disgusting, because I like to pull punches. And and this guy said, I don't believe that anyone should use that word, but, there are racists in every group, and she used the word in big deal.
Mm.
And I wrote back to him, and I said, you don't know about the dinner party with the slaves? With the people playing enslaved human beings? And he had no idea. So here's a white guy who's defending her, doesn't know the whole story,
assumes
he does, that's beyond just having it better than average people. This is goes beyond just, we've got it better so we don't know it. This is like, I'm ignorant to the facts and I'm still defending.
Right. Well, there's a lot of willful ignorance out there. I mean, people, one way that nobody wants to feel is guilty. People would rather feel just about any other way, I think.
Yeah.
And so if a very effective method of not feeling guilty is basically not knowing anything.
Yeah.
So and kind of shutting yourself off to the facts and only only reading or listening to the things that will back up what you already think or want to think.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That old ignorance is bliss thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so I was thinking that I was going to be able to have time to talk to you about your day job, but actually, can we save that for 2014?
Sure.
Okay, because I have some more questions about your writing here. It's kind of exciting.
Okay.
I don't want you to give the stories away because I know you want people to go and check your stuff out, and I want to be one of them. But no one was chasing Daniel Boone?
Yes.
What is that?
Well, that's an essay actually about what I was talking about a few minutes ago, just sort of feeling that essay sort of grew out of my sort of sense or my search rather for a sort of cultural identity to make sense of the fact that I was, you know, that I'm an American, but I'm a Black American. What does that mean? You know, I'm descended from Africa, but I'm not African. I live in the United States, which has, you know, traditionally discriminated against people who look like me. Mm-hmm. So how do you make sense of that? And the line, "No one was chasing Daniel Boone," actually is taken from a book by a late friend of mine, Albert Murray, in a book called The Omni-American. And he was talking about just the sort of rich, the richness of the Black American story. And what the line meant was that, you know, if you're a slave and you're running away from slave catchers, it's almost a better story than some of the sort of, you know, more traditional American stories like Daniel Boone,
uh-huh.
because no one was chasing Daniel Boone.
Yeah.
That's what that comes out of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, though, I was in, Diane Nyland and I were on a trip last February.
Mm-hmm.
And, there were signs, you know, someday when I have tons of time and millions of dollars, I'm just going to go around and go to every little historical marker.
Yeah.
You know, and see what they're all about. But there were these historical markers, and I'm going to destroy half of the story because I don't have my notes in front of me. But there were these little historical markers about some group or band, the blah, blah, blah band, who fled this part of the Wild West.
Mm.
And so I went online, and I called up the, you know, the blah, blah, blah band to see who they were. And it was a group of escaped enslaved people and Native Americans that they had built families with.
Mm.
So they had, Frederick Douglass talks about this in My Bondage Myself, where he, at times on Sundays, he could leave, and that's when he would go teach his classes. He'd go teach the other slaves to read, which was a big no-no. But he, these guys had families because they had their Sundays where they could leave, and they'd go meet people, and they struck up relationships, which all was, you know, way beyond the purview of what enslaved people were supposed to be able to do.
Right.
So
right.
They escape with this crowd, and they are finally tracked down, hunted down. A bunch of them are shot and killed, and others are just dragged back to slavery, including the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look this up, I get a National Parks story. And the story said something like I think it might have actually said cultural differences between, you know, the state that they lived in. And the state they were trying to get to.
Cultural differences.
Yeah, it was.
That's quite an understatement.
Yeah.
Maybe moral differences.
It even might have said moral conflict or something. But I mean, it was so soft pedaled.
That's called whitewashing history, I guess.
Oh, and after the whitewashing, you get the absolution.
Right. Right.
If one more person tells me, what's wrong with this? I didn't own any slaves. Right?
I didn't make anybody sit at the back of the bus. You know, that's the line I hear a lot.
So, you know, as a Black man, do you... And the other question I ask white men is, okay, well, so tomorrow, if I had a magic wand and I made you a Black man, would you be happy that I had just made you a Black man? Right? And none of them are honest.
Uh-huh.
None of them are honest.
Of course I would. Wouldn't make any difference.
I'd get away with murder then. Really? Is that why?
No, you'd get murdered. That's what.
Exactly. And you'd get charged with murder and found guilty whether you'd done it or not. Like Hurricane What's-His-Face.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of others we could go on with.
Exactly.
So when you write your... And as I look through some of these titles. Some of them look, I mean, I want to read everything you've written. You do a lot of book reviews. You do a lot of movie reviews and personal essays. But How to Eat Watermelon in Front of White People? It sounds
Right. That actually is a piece about Melvin Van Peebles, who's a filmmaker. Melvin Van Peebles made what is considered the first blaxploitation film, which is called Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. So there was a, and he went on to do many other things. He mounted a Broadway show. Huh. He wrote a novel, Ben French. And so that How to Eat Watermelon in Front of White People is actually the name of a documentary about Melvin Van Peebles, who's a fascinating figure. So
this is another one of your reviews.
Yeah, it's a review of the documentary.
When you do reviews and stuff, what's your angle? Is it just this was literarily appropriate, or is it, you know?
Well, what I try to do when I'm writing about anything, actually, is what I really get off on is our connections across genres and art forms.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, I'm listening to a tenor sax solo by Lester Young, which is Lester Young was the great rival of the tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins, and Lester Young played in a way that was very, very spare. Coleman Hawkins would play these solos, which were wonderful. They were full of notes, just notes all over the place. Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins would sort of work his way through the chords, playing every note. Lester Young would sort of do this thing where he sort of suggested the chords by playing these really innovative melodies, so that his style reminded me of Ernest Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ernest Hemingway would write about events, but he would leave out the emotions the character felt, but he would describe what happened, but not how it felt or what it meant. He would leave that to your imagination. Just the way that Lester Young would play these melodies that where he didn't play the notes of the chords, but he suggested the chords.
Huh.
So there was a lot. So those two figures, you know, the jazz man Lester Young and the famous writer Ernest Hemingway, in a way, you know, you wouldn't think of them as being alike at all, but they do this thing which to me is very similar. And so that's the sort of cultural connection that really turns me on.
Huh.
It's making connections between things that you would not think are really connected in any way.
Huh. And all of this is available at your blog for folks who want to check that out.
Yeah. Like and in my book, Love for Sale and Other Essays.
Yeah, I was just about to ask about. I'm extremely excited to read your review of Revenge of the Nerds, by the way.
That actual essay is about not so much. It's not about the film Revenge of the Nerds, but it's about blaxploitation film. So,
yeah.
It's called Revenge of the Nerd. The nerd being me.
Oh yay! I'm glad you got some. Okay, so yeah, you have, your newest book out is Love for Sale and Other Essays. Yes. And is this a collection of short stories?
No, it's nonfiction. It's essays. So some are it's personal experiences. Some pieces are about books. Some are about film. Some are about jazz. And as I said, the sort of connections among those different art forms.
Huh. And do you write fiction?
I do. My book, Signifying Nothing, the novel Signifying Nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right.
I discussed earlier.
And then we've got about 100 seconds left. Tell us about your awards.
Oh, okay. Well, this past fall, I was one of the recipients of the Whiting Writers Award. I got it in the category of nonfiction, and it's an award from the Whiting Foundation, and it's meant to recognize, as they put it, writers of accomplishment and you know, promise. So. Even though I'm 50, you know, I got hopefully have some promise as a writer. So,
I think they just looked at your picture and said, "The guy's only 24. Look at him; he's dynamic."
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about that.
That's wonderful. And then you got an even, like, didn't you get a huger award? Or?
Well, that was, as far as huge goes for me, that was the top one.
Wow.
Love for Sale won the nonfiction prize from Autumn House Press, which published it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. My prizes generally consist of, I came home and someone of my housemates has just done all the dishes.
That's the kind of prize I usually get, too.
And I'll tell you what, I'm pretty darn happy about it.
As you should be.
Cliff, what a treat. Thank you for taking some time tonight and talking about your great work. And I'm glad to know this work. I'm just going to refer people to you when I get in these situations now because, you know, you like to have backup that's got some sincerity and some reality behind it. And I think that's the hardest thing about arguing in favor of people. And it's also the challenge of doing it, of doing what we do for people in poverty, people in homelessness, you know, is, yeah, no, guess what? I really don't know what it feels like.
Right.
You know, right. I can pretend as long as I want to, but at the end of the day, I have a home.
I have a home, exactly.
So that having some street cred to back you up is pretty wonderful. Cliff,
well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, have a wonderful holiday, and we'll be giving you a call in early 2014, and we'll talk about some of the other great things you do.
That sounds great.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful. I'm Pat LaMarche. I'm sitting in for Rick Smith, who's off with his family, and we'll be right back.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Region 1C Director Norwood Jewell says the United Auto Workers Union wants to end the two-tier wage system at the Detroit 3. That system pays some new hires much less than veteran UAW members at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. Jewell told reporters in Flint, Michigan that the UAW hates the two-tier system and will work to get rid of it. New hires under the two-tier system now hire in at just under $16 an hour. That wage can rise to $19 over time, while veteran UAW members make about $28 an hour. Roughly 16% of GM's 51,000 UAW members make that lower wage. At Ford, it's about 19%, and at Chrysler, it's close to 25%. The UAW will be in contract talks with the Detroit 3 in 2015. Nancy Becker is an American working for Amazon in Germany. She traveled to Seattle recently to dare Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to try working as a picker in an Amazon warehouse for just a single week. She doesn't think he could survive it because the work is physically demanding and wages are low. These workers, known as pickers, pick out the merchandise ordered by Amazon customers for shipment. Amazon workers in Germany have been striking over the low pay and working conditions. Nancy Becker came to Seattle, Amazon's world headquarters, to participate in rallies driving home the point that while Bezos, other executives and Amazon shareholders are getting rich, Amazon workers are suffering. Becker says the Amazon system is characterized by low wages and permanent performance pressures. The National Institute on Retirement Security says blacks and Latinos in the United States own shockingly little assets for their retirements. In a recent report, the Institute says 62% of black American workers and 69% of Latino workers own no assets in retirement accounts. The report also notes that 3 out of 4 black households and 4 out of 5 Latino households, ages 25 to 64, have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. 1 out of 2 white households have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. In a different study, the Economic Policy Institute found that the American retirement system simply doesn't work for most workers and underscores the importance of preserving and strengthening Social Security and also defending the remaining defined benefit private pensions.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. We deserve more. We're worth more.
McDonald's is making $5.5 billion off of profits last year. Arby's made $1.5 billion off of profits last year. So why is we getting all these low minimum wage jobs? We sit up in a poor neighborhood trying to survive. Enough is enough. We're tired. It's time to rise up.
Keep the voices of workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day. Support Workers Independent News right now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money. Even if it has been money for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
I don't know. We're white men talking. Oh, my God. Ben Bernanke and Ron Paul. Oh, my God. What? First of all, how do these people get famous when they sound like they're field mice? Where's the robust orator? Blah, blah, blah. And then are you really arguing about, even though it was money for 6,000 years? You know what? If someone's willing to give you a loaf of bread for some gold filings, Ron, you're all set. Anyway, here to shed light in this dark, dank, seedy corner called the economy is my favorite professor, Professor Susan Feiner. How are you?
I'm good tonight, Pat. How are you?
I'm great. You got the rest of the year off. This is our last live program of the year. After tonight, we will air encore performances of our People's Tour across America when Brett, Rick, the regular show host, Carol, his wife, and their three children and I all traveled in a tiny RV 9,600 miles in 28 days.
Wow.
I know. We made radio every night. It was amazing. Brett, the producer, sat on a drink cooler in the middle of the RV with all of his recording gear and mixing board and everything on the table in the RV. And Rick and I taped the segments between the interviews for the program to make a program each day while we drove down the road.
Well, it was a good use of road time.
Yeah, it was insane. And it has yielded a whole pile of really great shows with incredible people. The interviews we had were great, but it also is the book I'm writing. So the book will be done.
Yeah, I'm excited to see.
So Ben Bernanke, is he still the head of the Fed?
He is until probably the early part of January when Yellen is
confirmed. She'll step up. Is she going to be better?
Well, she is much more of a traditional, you know, Keynesian kind of progressive economist. So she's someone who, in her writing and in what she said from her position on the other Fed boards that she's been on, is someone who prioritizes unemployment as an economic issue to be attacked, and she's more concerned about unemployment than she is about inflation. Yeah, I had a piece on Janet Yellen on the Women's E! News a couple of weeks ago, so readers could go to the womensenews.org and stick in my name or stick in Janet Yellen and read a short piece I had there. But, yeah, she is...
Now, wait a minute. Slow down. You write for this Women's E! News and we didn't know about it?
Well, sometimes I write for Women's E! News and I guess I didn't tell you, yeah.
Okay, cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to find this link you're talking about Janet Yellen. We're going to put it up on our page so that people can see it. And then we're going to keep posting stuff when you're doing that because that's great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like a deal.
That's how that whole networking, social networking thing they invented.
Yes, I know. And you're years younger than me, and I just get flabbergasted by it. And I press the wrong buttons on Facebook, and then everything just shorts out, and my hair gets really curly.
Maybe that's what's happened to me then. WomensyNews.org. We're going to look it up as soon as our segment's over, and we'll get that posted. Okay, so she's... I mean, if she's prioritizing unemployed people, that's pretty fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be limits to what she can do. But she's coming to her position at the head of the Fed with a much different perspective on the economy than Bernanke has. I mean, Bernanke, you know, was really touted how he was an expert on the Great Depression and so on and so forth. But they didn't tell
thing,
him,
huh?
Well, what it's odd in a way because he comes from the Chicago School of Economics, which is Milton Friedman. They're very, very extraordinarily conservative.
Uh-huh.
But Bernanke, because he did know so much about the Great Depression, knew that one of the things that definitely made it worse was when the Federal Reserve in 1930, 31, 32, and even early parts of 33, back then the president didn't get seated until March. So anyway,
the
Fed, in that period of time, after the crash and until FDR took office, the Fed was working, rather than pumping, you know, spending power into the economy, what they were doing was pulling funds out of the economy. It was totally perverse.
They is that what they're going to do now?
No. Now what they're doing is pumping less in or pumping in at a slower rate.
Tapering?
No, it's not taper. If you think of the U.S. economy as $16 trillion,
uh-huh.
Of that $16 trillion, if 5% of that is green pieces of paper, it's a lot. The vast majority of that $16 trillion are electronic splits between my bank and your bank.
Okay,
so
yeah.
Papering is not the right concept.
Because it's almost all electronic blips anyway.
It's electronic blips. It is a pure... to be technical here, it is a pure fiat currency. It is not convertible to anything.
Huh.
I mean, you can take your blip and buy euros, or you can take your blip and buy a Picasso, or you can take your blip and you can buy whatever you want with your blip, but there's nothing that the blips themselves are convertible into. They can't be converted into gold or silver or anything like that.
I was just going to say, are you starting to sound like Ron Paul?
I don't believe that. I think having a pure fiat currency is fabulous. It's free. It really eliminates the constraints, a lot of constraints on government spending that otherwise exist.
Back when you're on a gold or silver standard, you have to...
Exactly.
Yeah, I see.
So, Bernanke, knowing that the Fed had acted in exactly the wrong way in 1929, he did more or less the right thing by when the whole credit system was cratering and Lehman was going under and Bear Stearns and AIG didn't have anywhere near the cash it needed to cover those crazy positions they took in the mortgage swap market.
Yeah.
What the Fed did, without enough strings attached, but what the Fed did was it backstopped all of those corporations, which otherwise would have had to essentially go into insolvency, which would have caused the crash and ensuing depression to be like 10 times worse. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So he they did basically the right thing, but they didn't put any strings on it so that AI, you know, Golden could give everybody all those bonuses, and AIG could give bonuses, and in fact, Goldman and Morgan Stanley, maybe it was J.P. Morgan Chase, some of those other city, well, certainly Goldman, they actually were not banks regulated by the Federal Reserve before the crisis. So in order for them to get money from the Federal Reserve to prop them up so that they wouldn't go under, taking under with them how many other, you know, tens of thousands, if not more, businesses, the Fed had to, like, give them special dispensation and turn them into a bank, which they still aren't. I mean, technically, a bank, it takes my deposit and makes commercial loans, makes commercial and residential loans, right? That's a bank. But Goldman doesn't take anybody's deposit.
Right.
It's not a bank. But at any rate, this is pretty much inside baseball.
Yeah. So what's going to happen when they're going to tighten the number of blips so that there are a couple of $10 billion less or so?
What they've been doing is that they've been buying about $80 billion a month in U.S. Treasury. So now they're going to buy $70 billion a month. But U.S. Treasuries are 10-year, 20-year, 30-year notes.
So these are like loans?
They're long bonds. You buy it now, and you get interest payments over the life of the loan, and then at the end of it, you get the principal back. So it's like buying a bond from GM or something.
Okay.
It's a bond rather than a stock.
Right.
And so that when we have a deficit, this is where we were last night. When we have a deficit, the government sells these bonds to the public in order to get cash, right? Which is then going in the bank account of the government so that the government can spend it.
Okay, so does this mean that the recession's over?
Well, it means that the Fed thinks that the economy is on its feet well enough that it doesn't need to keep doing this, but the thing is, what the Fed has been doing hasn't done very much anyway. They're just, you know, what happens is, you've got a lot of rich people and hedge funds and everybody out there who hold U.S. government bonds because it's a very safe asset, and it pays interest. So, have I put you to sleep yet?
Nope. I'm here.
Okay. So these people are holding the U.S. government bonds. And so all they do is they sell them to the Fed. Fed buys them. Now the people have slips in their bank accounts that say $80 billion.
But the Fed's not going to buy as many.
Yeah, that's all.
But does that mean that the economy's improved?
No.
Does that mean the stock market will stay high?
It might.
Does this mean that the housing disaster is over?
Certainly not.
Okay, so why is it like the top of the fold on the New York Times, the Huffington Post?
Because we have, first of all, most people writing about this don't actually understand how a modern banking system works.
Yeah. They got to watch Zeitgeist.
They need to do a lot more than that. Actually, every single textbook that's out there with the title Money and Banking is wrong. It might as well have been written in 1300. That's how wrong it is. We cannot begin to talk about why and how it's wrong. People are just going to have to take it from me that it's wrong, and if they want to email me, I'm easy to find at the University of Southern Maine, and I can send you a couple things to read. But it's just, too friggin' complicated because it's just wrong.
Okay.
It's like thinking that...
It's like having a doctor come on in 2013 and tell us why we don't want leeches for the flu.
Something like that.
Yeah, okay, so we'll take your word for it.
It's along those lines.
Yeah.
It's just, okay. But the thing is, have you ever noticed... Yeah, pretty much every night on the national news, they tell you about the stock market,
yeah.
What it did that day.
Yeah.
Does the stock market have very much to do with the actual, real economy of people working and producing things and making our society better?
I think the only thing I've noticed is that it goes up a lot when a bunch of people lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So
the stock market is not an indicator of economic health. I mean, sometimes it is, but basically the stock market is just a legal casino. It's people making bets on whether or not pieces of paper are going to be worth, and the stock market actually is pieces of paper. There actually are stock certificates. But people have just completely fetishized this stock market thing, like it's the economy, and the stock market is not the economy.
Yeah, and things like the price of gasoline and milk and bread and stuff are far more important to the average person.
And the more important indicators of people's well-being.
Huh.
And even the prices aren't what really super important. What's important is how much of the actual stuff there is. I mean, let's say a gallon of milk today costs $1, and there's 100 of them in the United States, 100 gallons of milk. And tomorrow, a gallon of milk costs $2, and there's still only 100 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Has anything substantively changed? No. Just the number we attach to a gallon of milk. And so one of the things that economists, and progressive economists in particular, are always trying to make clear to people is that we need to be talking about the actual quantity of milk in the economy, the actual number of jobs in the economy, the purchasing power of people's wages, the actual physical manifestation of our resource, not these ephemeral, the prices, not the stock market, not the what the Federal Reserve is doing, which is like at 100 paces removed from what I call the real economy. And
yeah,
it's real in the sense, not that there's some fake economy out there, but it's real in the sense of it being physical and actual.
Well, then the real economy has some things going on in it, too. There was a poll released, a Washington Post ABC News poll released today that says that 64% of Americans now want the minimum wage to be $10.25.
Yay.
I know. That's huge.
That's a lot more important than what Ben Bernanke says.
That's like a 37% increase in the wages of minimum wage people. Which isn't...
If that passed, yes. That's exactly what that is. And that would be huge. That would be huge. And you know what's good?
Is it going to close down every McDonald's? Because that's what they... Well, you know, we're not going to have to shed an awful lot of jobs.
No, it wouldn't shut down McDonald's because the purchasing power increase would generate enough more sales that profits wouldn't budge. Now, there might be reallocation of jobs. In other words, some of the places that absolutely, you know, think about the factory in Bangladesh, for goodness sake, that couldn't operate unless it changed 5-year-olds to the sewing machine.
Right.
So if those places went out of business, that would be good.
Right.
Because it's pure exploitation. And there are businesses in the United States that would probably go out of business at a $10 and something an hour minimum wage.
And good riddance to them. I mean,
but those are not businesses that we want to have.
Right. And when Walmart threatened Washington, D.C. and said that if they raised the minimum wage, they were going to leave, why did anyone care?
Well, there is a displacement period, no question about it. And for the period of time between when the people who lose their jobs, it's going to take them a while to find new jobs, and our unemployment compensation system is so horrendous.
Right.
There will be real serious suffering.
I just was thinking, you know, businesses would open up and fill that need.
Right, but again, it takes time. And people who don't get paychecks are going to suffer.
Right.
In the meantime. Walmart is not going to suffer, but the people who don't have jobs while all that adjustment. And that's what we have a social safety net for, is because the economy is so ever-changing. And you lose jobs here and you get them over there. And when people need assistance in making a transition, that's what safety nets are about. That's what unemployment compensation is about. That's what food stamps are about.
So we only have about 3 minutes left, and I want to talk about the bullies in Congress.
How do we use up our time so fast?
I have no idea. It just flies. And it's amazing to me because this is probably the hardest thing for me to understand. And I was a math major in college, but math and economics and even accounting are not the same things. And
no.
Anyone who thinks they are crazy. But anyway, so Representative Jack Kingston, a Republican from Georgia, doesn't like free lunch. In fact, on Saturday, he came out against the notion of poor children getting a school lunch. He said that free lunches are over. Children should have to pay at least a nominal amount or work for their lunch.
Mm-hmm. I think that should apply, actually, all the way down to infants. And I don't see why it should be school kids. I mean, really, when you take your baby home from the hospital and that baby wants some food, charge that little sucker a nickel. I mean, you take those foods, it hurts. Why should they get to suckle at their mother's breast for free? Nothing's free in this world, man.
Yeah. And
you got to keep them young.
You can actually watch this man say these things, which is beyond me. He says that kids should at least have to pay a dime. They shouldn't learn that there's a free lunch. There's no such thing as a free lunch. I would love to see these guys who get their congressional lunches paid for start doing a little work.
Well, you know, Cory Booker did that thing where he tried to live for a week on a food stamp budget. And quite a number of members of the House and of the Senate and in many of the states have tried to do the same thing. And it's really horrible. It's very, very difficult to do. And the impact on your health is pretty, you know, it doesn't take but a couple of weeks of really bad nutrition for you to start having physical manifestations of it.
Yeah. One of the people who's vociferously arguing against this guy, I guess it's his opponent down there in Georgia, said, but rich kids get a free lunch from their parents.
Yeah, and then this guy goes, well, it's their parents. Their parents work for it. At some point...
Are these all just talking points so that these little
kids are dependent. They're dependent, and their parents are, for whatever reason, unable to give the children the nourishment they need. And what this kind of conservative, mean-spirited thing is, it's an acting out of their own fear that people would treat them this way. You know, they're terrified that if they were dependent, nobody would love them enough to help them.
I think so they might be right.
Well, if you act that way, nobody is going to help you.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Awful. Well, Susan, I hope you have a wonderful holiday season.
You too.
Do you have big New Year's Eve plans?
Oh, we never have big New Year's Eve plans. Another night. That's one of the problems of being an economist. You know, you really get the idea of how arbitrary these numbers are.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking. I'll see you on Facebook, of course, and I'm sure we'll be talking in 2014. But have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season and a happy new year.
You too. Enjoy yourself, Pat.
Thank you.
Good fun.
Professor Susan Finer, Professor of Economics and Women's Studies. I'm Pat Lamar, Spillman for Rick Smith, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Region 1C Director Norwood Jewell says the United Auto Workers Union wants to end the two-tier wage system at the Detroit 3. That system pays some new hires much less than veteran UAW members at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. Jewell told reporters in Flint, Michigan that the UAW hates the two-tier system and will work to get rid of it. New hires under the two-tier system now hire in at just under $16 an hour. That wage can rise to $19 over time, while veteran UAW members make about $28 an hour. Roughly 16% of GM's 51,000 UAW members make that lower wage. At Ford, it's about 19%, and at Chrysler, it's close to 25%. The UAW will be in contract talks with the Detroit 3 in 2015. Nancy Becker is an American working for Amazon in Germany. She traveled to Seattle recently to dare Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to try working as a picker in an Amazon warehouse for just a single week. She doesn't think he could survive it because the work is physically demanding and wages are low. These workers, known as pickers, pick out the merchandise ordered by Amazon customers for shipment. Amazon workers in Germany have been striking over the low pay and working conditions. Nancy Becker came to Seattle, Amazon's world headquarters, to participate in rallies driving home the point that while Bezos, other executives and Amazon shareholders are getting rich, Amazon workers are suffering. Becker says the Amazon system is characterized by low wages and permanent performance pressures. The National Institute on Retirement Security says blacks and Latinos in the United States own shockingly little assets for their retirements. In a recent report, the Institute says 62% of black American workers and 69% of Latino workers own no assets in retirement accounts. The report also notes that 3 out of 4 black households and 4 out of 5 Latino households, ages 25 to 64, have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. 1 out of 2 white households have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. In a different study, the Economic Policy Institute found that the American retirement system simply doesn't work for most workers and underscores the importance of preserving and strengthening Social Security and also defending the remaining defined benefit private pensions.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. We deserve more. We're worth more.
McDonald's is making $5.5 billion off of profits last year. Arby's made $1.5 billion off of profits last year. So why are we getting all these low minimum wage jobs? We sit up in a poor neighborhood trying to survive. Nothing's enough. We're tired. It's time to rise up.
Keep the voices of workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day. Support Workers Independent News right now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Somebody's watching.
Somebody's watching you. It's the peeping Tom Bama. No, it didn't work. Marcy Wheeler from EmptyWheel.net is joining us right now. We're going to talk about the NSA. Marcy, shh, they're listening.
Well, hopefully they're listening. This is radio, right?
Exactly. Now, metadata, it doesn't matter, it's just blips. They, you know how many times you use your phone, so does your phone company. Why are you guys all overreacting? But a judge says no. It's not overreacting.
A judge and the president's handpicked whitewash committee say no.
Now, does the president know they said that?
Yeah. And we'll see. We'll see how he was originally not going to release the report until mid-January after he took it to Hawaii and had a chance to read it. But
to
I
hide
think,
it with his birth certificate so the birthers would all, you know, sorry.
Right, he's going to leave it in Kenya. Here's what I think of your whitewash report that ended up not being a whitewash report. Send it to Kenya.
So, is he doing this because he's got an awful lot of egg on his face and he's not looking good right now?
It's not entirely clear. One thing that really important background is that the whitewash committee that ended up not being a whitewash recommended splitting the director of NSA from Cyber Command, and that's kind of a technical issue, but a lot of it has to do with how aggressive we're going to be in the internet. And they kind of delivered the results of this report to Obama on Thursday. It was leaked to the press, and then Friday the White House came out and said, "Whoa, we're not going to do that. We are not following that recommendation." So he's already started pushing back against at least that recommendation that's in here. And I, you know, reading it, I can see Keith Alexander's eyes probably popped out 100 times as he read it, which I giggle a little bit about. I just wish we had video of it. but you know, it's unclear whether, I mean, it seems very clear to me that this got released because of the judge's decision yesterday. Richard Leon in D.C. District said this stuff is unconstitutional. And it accords with what he said in significant part. I mean, it basically says, as you were talking about metadata, it basically says, you know that rule that's over 30 years old that they use to say we don't really care about our phone metadata privacy? Well, that's out of date. And that's exactly what the whitewash committee that ended up not being a whitewash said. They said there are serious, you know, everyone lives online. There are serious privacy implications.
Me up a little bit because, you know, quite frankly, I really don't understand this. I have an identity that nobody in their right mind would steal. I'm a pretty public person. I live on the radio for the most part. I've been in the media for 25 years. I have never even guessed or joked that I might have privacy. Never thought about it, you know.
Right.
I used to tell the kids, we don't need curtains. The neighbors will buy them. But other than that, you know, it was just, I don't know what they said 30 years ago when everybody just had a dial-up phone. Were they trying to get people's information about their dial-up phones?
They were trying to find a crook. So they were doing it in one case. That's what the Supreme Court said with Kosher back in 1979.
Oh, in this one case?
One guy, a couple weeks of data, we're going to use it to find out whether he's a crook. So, and they've used that case to legitimize getting every single human being's phone data in the United States.
Okay, so I don't want to sound really stupid, but I'm very likely, possibly very stupid. Why did they just get a warrant for one guy?
Just because the question is, I mean, they didn't, and so he challenged it, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, this isn't as private as the stuff you would need to get a warrant for. I mean, that's the basic. And since then, there's been this general distinction between content super private, metadata, so your call records, your to and from lines in your email, that stuff, based on that Supreme Court decision, aren't considered quite as private. But our understanding of what metadata is and can show has changed dramatically since then.
Huh. So how do you get to see all this stuff, by the way?
How do I get to see what?
Like the judge's rulings and the whitewash report and all that. How do you get to see it?
Oh, it's all on the intertube. The whitewash report people can find at the White House.
Ah.
It's on the White House's intertube intertuberness. They'll probably figure out the IP address of everyone who goes and downloads it, because you're probably all geek, you know. The court ruling is also available on the Institute. See how magical this stuff is? And you can download it, but you have to pay. Well, actually, that you don't have to pay money for, and it's floating around everywhere. If people want to look for it, the judge's name is Richard Leon, and the case is Larry Klayman. He's the guy who heads Judicial Watch, kind of in that case, but he's entitled to his rights too.
Yeah.
He's entitled
to be in that case, in fact.
And that's part of the issue. I mean, one of the reasons why Klayman makes an interesting plaintiff in this case, the ACLU is suing on their own behalf in New York. Same kinds of issues, which is that both of them are always in an antagonistic position with the government, and the government can, if it has their metadata, which it does, can just look it up and find out who they're consulting with, maybe what members of Congress are talking to them, maybe what former Gitmo detainees might be talking to them. I mean, there's with both Larry Klayman and the ACLU, you very quickly get into some concerning implications. The EFF has a suit in California that is neat because it's got the NRA, so you know strange bedfellows everywhere.
Yeah.
But importantly, one of the things that I don't think it's talked enough about this is that if you go three hops into phone records, you see the actual rather than the nominal structural organization of various kinds of entities. So I did an example way back when. In addition to actual terrorists, they can use this phone dragnet to find Iranians. And a friend of mine happens to be Iranian-American and happens to have a fairly significant position at a labor union. And I pointed out that if his phone calls to his grandmother in Iran, if they did contact chaining off of that, then at the third hop, you would have the structure of the union he works for.
Now, what do you mean by structure?
You would know what this kind of contact chaining is meant to show is who are the really important people. Not, you know, who's the CEO, but who's the person who, if that person disappeared off the face of the earth, the entire organization would take 6 months having to recover. They actually use the same kind of contact, the same kind of network analysis when they do signature strikes, certain kinds of drone strikes overseas. But you can see organizationally, in organizations you've belonged to, there's one person who knows where everything is kept, who knows the institutional history, who everyone trusts, everyone talks to, and you can identify that person from this kind of network analysis.
Okay,
kind of
so, and I don't want to sound too stupid, and so if I'm tedious, tell me and we'll move on. But
No.
So
good.
We've got a guy, and he's the secretary of the union, and he's calling his grandmother in Iran, and he calls three times, and after the third time, the NSA says, Susie, the woman who puts, gives everybody the jobs in the morning, she's the most important person at that place. How can they tell that from his phone calls?
Oh, because when they say contact chaining, they're not actually going, they're not just interested in grandmother's call to the union employee in the United States. They can go three hops in. So in other words, first they get grandma to the union employee, mm-hmm. and then they get everyone that union employee calls. And some of those people are going to be in the union. I'm going to be one of those people. I'm not in the union, but I'm, you know, supportive of it.
Yeah.
Some of the people are going to be people trying to organize a union.
Uh-huh.
And then they go one more hop out. So all of the people that Iranian-American union employee talks to, and then they talk to. And you
so it's like a pyramid scheme.
It's sort of a pyramid scheme, but there's going to be overlap because, you know, it could be that my friend speaks to Joe and Susie, but Susie also always speaks to Joe, and Bob always speaks to Joe, and then that's how you discover that Joe's the critical link.
I see.
And so that's what they're doing. They're trying to find who are the critical people in these networks. And their assumption is, and there's no reason to believe they've actually ever proven this. And in fact, there's probably a good reason to believe they haven't proven it. But their assumption is that that person, the Joe, who everyone calls, is going to be the one who's most likely to be a terrorist, or the one who they can wiretap and figure out what kind of terrorist plots are going on.
Just because somebody's staying with this analogy, just because somebody's got a grandmother in Iran, and so that flagged them to be following those phone calls.
Well, we don't know, and that's part of the problem. We know that probably to start with a grandmother in Iran, they'd have to say, well, we think she's tied to the regime in some nasty way. But given that they're doing this on Iran, which doesn't have terrorists like Al-Qaeda, I mean, Al-Qaeda has certain key terrorists, right? So if you're talking to Anwar al-Awlaki on the phone, then chances are good that they're going to try. You're going to get picked up on this.
But wait a minute. But aren't they doing this to just about everybody?
No, they only start, or at least as they say, they only start, and this is for the stuff that happens in the United States. They do the same thing for collections they've collected overseas, some of which is also going to include Americans' data. And that one, we have no idea what the rules are for, and they're not rushing to tell us. But for the stuff that they get that is exclusively United States, the phone calls, they're supposed to only be able to start the chaining process from somebody they have sort of reason to believe might be associated with a terrorist organization. So, but let me go back to the union analogy. What are the chances that, say, somebody from FARC in Colombia has ties to labor? It's not insignificant. And so there are easy scenarios to imagine where this kind of contact chaining would involve labor people in the United States and then would quickly begin to map out the labor structure in the United States. And one of the interesting things about it is this three-hop rule used to be a way to kludge around it and do a four-hop rule until 2009. We think that's probably what they were, or I think that's probably what they were doing when Cheney invented the program. And once they get your data, once they get you mapped into, I mean, so, For
Cheney,
example,
like in Dick Cheney?
Yeah, he's the guy who started all of this, and then they tried to make it legal, and that's what we've got in front of us now.
You know, I'm always so interested in the chuckleheads who think that if their guy's doing it, it'll be fine, and there won't be a new guy that comes along afterwards. Like when all the Republican rank-and-file decent people, I mean really nice people, were like, well, we need this, it's important, we have to have this. I'm like, do you think those guys are going to stay in power forever? Somebody else is going to come in power, and it's probably somebody you don't like. So now all those chuckleheads who are okay with Cheney and Bush doing this are now extremely upset that President Obama is doing this, but they were fine.
And some people who were unhappy about Cheney doing it are perfectly happy
now
with Obama doing it.
Yeah, I know. And,
here's the thing that both of those people are forgetting. It's not President Obama who's doing it, nor is it George Bush. It might be Dick Cheney, probably, maybe, but it's not really the president who's doing it. It's the same national security people who are doing it. And they may be nice people. They may be well-intentioned people, but they're also people who are in a bubble. Mm-hmm. And in that bubble, they often forget that you know, there are people who have legitimate reasons, for example, to talk to people who might look like terrorists or might not be, including journalists, including human rights activists. And those people have a legitimate politically, you know, constitutionally protected right to engage in the activities they're doing, but this chaining ends up criminalizing them or potentially criminalizing them, or it ends up getting their it ends up making it more likely that their phone conversations are going to be wiretapped. So I think that's the problem. It's not, you know, the Republicans may have been perfectly happy with Bush doing this. The Democrats might be perfectly happy with Obama doing it. The truth is, it is national security bureaucrats who are doing the thing, and they're in a bit of a bubble, and forget that, you know, not everything that looks like a terrorist inside a big computer is actually a terrorist.
So, Marcy, you know, I find it very upsetting that they can do this and then send a drone in. I mean, I don't like the drones anyway. They upset the living daylights out of me all the time, and I think it makes President Obama a war criminal. But they have, you know, we just killed a bunch of kids with a drone. So if they're using this metadata to isolate the target, for want of a more
that's
human...
That's in part what they're doing. They're doing... Well, we don't know for sure what they're doing with the drones, but they're doing that. I mean, you know, they're doing some things where they say, oh, there's Anwar al-Awlaki, let's take him out with the drone.
Right.
But then they're doing other things where they're like, we don't know who all those Yemenis are, but this guy looks like Joe from the Union. He's the guy everyone talks to, and if we take him out, then, you know, H2AP is going to be kind of reeling for the next couple of months until they replace Joe.
Boy, that's
they
pretty
don't
awful.
Do, yeah, they, and they don't, there's no reason
wow.
to believe they do it just with phone and internet data. They probably also float around in their drones and say, hey, look, Joe also has face-to-face meetings with all these people. So it's not just the computer analysis that they're using in drones, or there's, you know, I don't believe it's just that. I think it also includes the visual and other analysis that the drone itself picks up. But it's a similar kind, what they're trying to do, the same kind of thing, which sort of makes sense, but again, it's not clear, and this is one of the things the whitewash that turned out not to be a whitewash recommended, is they're like, hey, let's actually see some data that all this network analysis works. We should have done that back in 2001 before we rolled out all of these dragnets, but you know they sort of said, "Hey, maybe this stuff doesn't work all that well."
So, is there? And that, you probably can't answer this, but if this is the potential for use abroad, there's no reason to think this isn't the potential for use domestically. And then when you say that, you all, if anyone does have the audacity to say, you know, they could triangulate on to a person and take them out because they've decided all this information points to their intricacies in this and their role in this organization. So we just, you know, we get rid of the head and the body runs around like a crazy thing for 6 months. But that is the potential of this sort of information.
It's one of them.
Yeah.
It's one, and there are a couple of other things that are going on now that I think I'm actually concerned about. One is there's some indication they're using this network analysis to do things like put people on no-fly lists and to you know name them terrorists at the Treasury Department, and there's no legitimate court review for that stuff right now. And so and it happens that people get on no-fly or secondary screening lists, and their lives become miserable.
Right.
And that's a real concern. Another thing that really, really concerns me is that they've admitted they use this network analysis to find people to turn into informants. And not only is that troubling because, you know, they're finding Joe, if they get Joe to be an informant in that union, then, it allows them to kind of pick and choose who they want to recruit to be their informant, but it also probably gives them some leverage over the person. So in other words, if you have metadata analysis on somebody and you see that he's, you know, supposed to be a conservative Muslim, but he seems to be talking to this woman who's not his wife at odd hours a day, then, you know, it's not inconceivable that you go collect the information that they're having an affair and then you use that to coerce the guy into becoming an informant. It's that kind of thing that metadata analysis allows you to do. And we know they're using it to find informants. We don't know how that process works, but the fact that they're doing it to me is one of the scariest parts of it.
Okay, but any James Bond fan would tell you, well, they could do this 100 years ago, but they just had to use a lot more people. So nothing's really changed.
They had to use a lot more people. We know that the number of informants in this country has grown really significantly since 9/11, not all related to the war on terror. A lot of it's also, I mean, you know, they're going to keep getting informants in the drug war until they're blue in the face. But,
right.
But, and it's not, you know, it's definitely not the scale of the Stasi, but for certain communities, the proliferation of informants is really, I think, detrimental to their civil liberty, to their rights, their ability to politically organize. And so it, for that purpose, you know, it makes the process easier. It makes the process more effective. It makes it, you know, it just makes the whole process quicker and cheaper and faster. And so one of my questions is, do they have more informants because it's easier for them to find the people who will make good informants from a structural standpoint? I don't know the answer to that, but those are the kinds of questions that we should be able to get answers to, and we're nowhere close to that right now.
Marcy, how much have we, as the taxpayer who now, you know, has cut food stamps, how much have we spent for these surveillance programs?
Well, NSA gets what, $50 billion? No. The intelligence community gets like $70 billion, and a lot of that goes to satellites. It's not, you know, a lot of that goes to hardware, not to people. So maybe $20 billion a year is a better...
But the satellites are there to help the people do this stuff, right? So
it is, yeah.
That would still be figured
out. But satellites are less effective at, you know, I mean, to some degree they're getting phone calls, but they're also, you know, they're getting pictures and stuff like that. I'm happy for them to get pictures of whether or not the Russians are building new nukes. That's okay with me. But
how about pictures of whether or not we are? Because we've got a $500 trillion worth of new nukes on order.
Well, we can't tell ourselves because it's secret. I don't know how you found out. You probably have to go to jail now, because if you know it, then you clearly have been, you're practically a spy.
You know what? I am so worthless. I've been, like, beating my breast and rallying against the machine basically since I was about 18, so 35 years, and I haven't accomplished a thing. I didn't stop any wars. I didn't get world peace. And, you know, they're just like, oh, ignore her. You know?
Yeah.
It's
but you're still doing it, so.
You know what I don't understand is if this, and I'm no Democrat. I'm a Green, which means I'm a problem.
Which means you're probably being wiretapped anyway because you're a hippie.
Yeah, but we're powerless. Monsanto might be after me, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, let me say this, but that is one of the obvious concerns. Kevin Gostola at Fire Dog Lake reported on Texas using a terrorism law to arrest some Keystone protesters. And it is, you know, we've seen it before with ELF. We've seen, environmental activists being prosecuted as terrorists. And the only thing that prevents somebody, the next George Bush, from using these dragnets against environmentalists as terrorists is having to prove some kind of international connection, which if you're Greenpeace is easy as pie. And so that's a great example of how it is very conceivable that these programs get blown out of proportion by things that at least you and me seems perfectly, you know, like somebody's got to start saving the globe.
Exactly, and all of it, you know, all the stuff. Like I spend most of my time on poverty issues, and people need shoes, you know. So you can decide that, you know, I'm trying to overthrow the capitalist, out of control capitalist machine, and have a problem with me for that. But you know, quite frankly, it wouldn't necessarily be wrong. I do think that we should redistribute the wealth. But all of that aside, and now that I've disclaimed that I'm not an apologist for the Democratic Party or a Democrat, why is it the constant joke that Al Gore invented the Internet and nobody talks about the fact that Dick Cheney invented basically the NSA?
Well, he didn't invent it. I mean, it was there beforehand, and it was there
but he's
in the 70s.
He's turned this electronic eye on people, and I just want him ridiculed for that, even if it's not true, like Al Gore inventing the Internet is not true.
Well, Al Gore inventing the Internet is close to the truth, but the myth about Al Gore that drives me nuts is that now every time we see more proof that climate change is happening, I joke that Al Gore is fat, and And I try. Here's my plan to save the globe. Is I think we should declare Fat Al Gore, who is a distinct entity from Al Gore, the human person who got elected president in 2000. But Fat Al Gore, we name him a terrorist, and then we'll finally do something in this country to combat climate change.
Why would we?
Well, because if he's a terrorist, then he must do that.
Oh.
See what I'm, see?
Yeah.
I'm using that fear factor. I'm trying to work this system.
Yeah. Good luck with that. You know, the people who like the fear thing, they're crazy. So they don't make you see.
Yeah, but they're crazy, but they own everything. And so.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Marcy Wheeler from EmptyWheel.net, thanks so much for taking some time and explaining this to me, because it's so much clearer for me now, and it wasn't that complicated, but it also didn't make any sense.
Well, they're trying to make sure it doesn't make any sense. So anyway, good to be here.
Wonderful.
Thanks for
having
me.
To have you. Have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year.
You too.
Thanks. I'm Pat LaMarshall, and then for Rick Smith, he's off in Florida with his lovely family. We'll be back in 2014. And we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Region 1C Director Norwood Jewell says the United Auto Workers Union wants to end the two-tier wage system at the Detroit 3. That system pays some new hires much less than veteran UAW members at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. Jewell told reporters in Flint, Michigan that the UAW hates the two-tier system and will work to get rid of it. New hires under the two-tier system now hire in at just under $16 an hour. That wage can rise to $19 over time, while veteran UAW members make about $28 an hour. Roughly 16% of GM's 51,000 UAW members make that lower wage. At Ford, it's about 19%, and at Chrysler, it's close to 25%. The UAW will be in contract talks with the Detroit 3 in 2015. Nancy Becker is an American working for Amazon in Germany. She traveled to Seattle recently to dare Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to try working as a picker in an Amazon warehouse for just a single week. She doesn't think he could survive it because the work is physically demanding and wages are low. These workers, known as pickers, pick out the merchandise ordered by Amazon customers for shipment. Amazon workers in Germany have been striking over the low pay and working conditions. Nancy Becker came to Seattle, Amazon's world headquarters, to participate in rallies driving home the point that while Bezos, other executives, and Amazon shareholders are getting rich, Amazon workers are suffering. Becker says the Amazon system is characterized by low wages and permanent performance pressures. The National Institute on Retirement Security says blacks and Latinos in the United States own shockingly little assets for their retirements. In a recent report, the Institute says 62% of black American workers and 69% of Latino workers own no assets in retirement accounts. The report also notes that 3 out of 4 black households and 4 out of 5 Latino households, ages 25 to 64, have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. 1 out of 2 white households have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. In a different study, the Economic Policy Institute found that the American retirement system simply doesn't work for most workers and underscores the importance of preserving and strengthening Social Security and also defending the remaining defined benefit private pensions.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. We deserve more. We're worth more.
McDonald's is making $5.5 billion off of profits last year. Arby's made $1.5 billion off of profits last year. So why are we getting all these low minimum wage jobs? We sit up in a poor neighborhood trying to survive. Nothing's enough. We're tired. It's time to rise up.
Keep the voices of workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day. Support Workers Independent News right now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm an innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm down on my luck. Bullets and lawyers, guns and money. Guns and money.
Winding down to our last hour. I love that song. And when I used to work for Stephen King, the you know, the guy, the novelist, the guy who writes scary books, he had a whole pile of the stuff from that song, the original things that they used for the video, which was pretty cool. I love that song. Be stuck, you know, between your luck, down on your luck, stuck between a rock and a hard place, all those things. I guess you could say that nothing, no phrase could more deficiently describe what happened in Fukushima Prefecture back in 2011 than the fact that people were down on their luck and between a rock and a hard place when an earthquake struck and then a tsunami and then a nuclear power plant, Fukushima Daiichi power plant, basically melted down. Whenever we have questions about that, we go to Nancy Faust, who is joining me right now. Hey, Nancy.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing good.
Great. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. This is our last live program of 2013, so I want to thank you for making it.
Great.
We're going to do encore performances of shows that we produced over the summer on our People's Tour for America. Really great stuff. We hope people will tune in for that. But I kind of reached out to you today because there was a lawsuit filed by members of the United States Navy who were exposed to radiation at Fukushima Daiichi when they responded to the disaster. And what happened? That lawsuit's been thrown out?
It's been thrown out a second time on a technicality. They did say they are going to refile the lawsuit.
So explain what the lawsuit's of, why are they suing, first of all?
It's kind of a strange situation. The sailors that are bringing the lawsuit are suing TEPCO, but they're suing them in the United States court system. And that's what's created some of these kind of legal oddities that has caused the case to be tossed and then refiled a couple of times.
And TEPCO, for people who don't know, is the electric company that owned the nuclear power plant.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So these sailors filed their suit, and they've had to refile it a couple of times. The gist of the suit is when they were all on the USS Ronald Reagan, they responded to the disaster, they were near offshore from the plant. At this point in time, TEPCO was insisting there was nothing major going on, there were no meltdowns, everything was sort of being handled. The Japanese government, at least publicly, was echoing that to the public, that there were no meltdowns at this point. Well, what we know now is, of course, there were, and they were pretty severe, and there was already radiation leaks going on very early in the disaster. So while these sailors were near offshore, there was quite a bit going on. What has gotten a little confusing is, of course, this being a lawsuit, they're not giving out all of the information that they may have. But in kind, the Navy is only putting out little bits of information, so there's lots of things that nobody really knows about the case right now.
So this is similar to what happened to the first responders at 9/11 when Christy Todd Whitman said, oh, there's nothing bad in the air. Go ahead down there. You don't need protection of any kind. I mean, this is just sort of status quo or you know, the average way that people are handled when there's an emergency and the powers that be are sort of like kicking the dust and saying, oh, it's not going to be me down there, so I'm sure they'll be fine.
It seems like it was a little bit of both. It was a little bit of kind of chaos of what was going on, and it sounded like maybe some down lower in the food chain in the Navy weren't quite aware of what was going on. And from what we know from conversations that the NRC had to make public, there was quite a bit of chaos going on even in the upper levels of the government at that point. This is kind of why I think the suit has focused so heavily on TEPCO, is because they knew what was going on and were lying to everyone. but the sailors that were on the ship did not have proper protection in many cases. They weren't told, to wear radiation protection. There was a number of them that were doing things like changing filters out on helicopters without any protection on, air filters on the ship. There was reports of sailors that were changing air filters out without gas masks on. And it seems to, what we found out so far from cases where they where the individuals have coughed, these are the type of things they're saying happened where it was kind of individual, where it was someone that was out on the deck more than the other one, or there was some reason they were in contact with, heavier level of contamination. And these are the people that have ended up getting sick.
Oh. So these guys are already sick. Again, I'm going to hearken it back to 9/11 when John Stewart, of all people, had the first responders on because they couldn't get their health care. And even though they were visibly made ill, and factually made ill by the work that they did after the disaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, there's been a number of different health problems people have cited, and this is out of the sailors that are part of the suit. All sorts of different health problems, thyroid problems, different other sorts of problems that could be related to radiation issues. And also there's been a number of them that have come down with cancer. This has become really kind of contentious in the public, and the fact that not all the information is out. People are trying to make off-the-cuff decisions on whether this is accurate or not, but there's just not enough information to tell for sure.
Now,
and the big thing with the cancer is they're saying that it's too early for them to have cancer. But what we're seeing in the children from Fukushima is many of them have showed up with thyroid cancer already, which is highly unusual for them to be showing so early compared to what they had seen in Chernobyl. But the numbers are so large that now there's starting to be some rethink of that in Japan, too.
Okay, now what's the unit of bad stuff that they measure, the unit that they use to measure, if there's too much of something in the atmosphere or contaminating things?
They'll use like a general level rather than looking at specific isotopes. So they'd say there's a certain number of thyroids in the air, or they detected a certain number of becquerels.
Okay.
So there's usually like a general, like an air radiation or water radiation, just a general level of what they're detecting.
I was doing a talk morning show, within 6 months of the meltdown, and I had on a cancer specialist from Bryn Mawr and a radiation specialist, radiation oncologist, and he said, based on whatever these units were that they were measuring, he said, I will predict right now that there'll be at least another 100 extra cases of cancer for the ones that we would normally get. And if you're a person that didn't sound like that many, but, if you're one of the 100, it doesn't matter. It's just awful.
Right. Right.
So back in the day, this is, again, it was still 2011, it didn't seem like when you talk to people who do radiation oncology and things like that for a living that anybody was going to be too surprised that they were going to come back with cancers.
Yeah, and most of what we saw, people were saying, people are getting exposed. Somebody's going to get cancer out of it. And the big defining factor is how much radiation was truly released from the plant, which is still up for debate. The academic literature on this is very widely. So, the actual amount of radiation that was released is one thing, and that's still up in the air. And then it's also kind of highly personal. Where were you at a certain time when, the concentrations in a certain area were high?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, how people are getting their exposures, and the exposures can be widely varied. They even found with some of the government researchers that were running around taking radiation readings, at the very early stage of the disaster, were coming back in and then getting their thyroids checked, and two guys that were out on the same mission together were coming back with different exposure levels. They were in the exact same environment, doing the exact same thing, wearing the exact same equipment, coming back with two different levels of exposure.
So it appears that if a sane person was doing this whole thing, that these guys would have a leg to stand on. Why are they filing in the United States if it keeps getting thrown out? Why don't they file it in Japan?
I'm not sure why they're not filing it in Japan. It may be that they feel that the United States court system is more favorable. The Japanese court system is quite different from the U.S. system, and my understanding is lawsuits are not nearly as common in Japan as they are in the United States. That may have something to do with it. They may have decided there's some jurisdictional advantage but they've also run into this challenge of trying to establish a legal ground for suing a foreign company over something that happened, you know, basically in another country here in the state.
Huh. But they must, people must sue in other countries all the time.
Right, and that's what's getting into kind of a corporate law type thing that I'm not real familiar with.
Okay.
But I'm assuming they have some sort of a justification. And it sounded like when this last time that the court case was thrown out that the judge was of the mind that she knew it was going to come back through. And so it sounded like it was more of a procedural issue or something rather than the entire concept of the case being something that sounded objectionable.
I see. Is it? It's got to be frustrating, though, because these people who are ill, I mean, maybe because they're U.S. service people, they'll be taken care of. But, you know, especially in the United States, the thing they shouldn't be doing in the United States is getting their health care here, you know, where it's five times the price of anywhere else.
Right. And this is a concern, and I have not heard anything in recent months. This was a question that was up in the air, are these veterans getting any sort of service connected for this at this point? We haven't heard anything as far as veterans benefits or DOD care or anything like that. So, you know, we don't know that these people are coming back and they're sick. Are they even getting any health care at the VA? Or are they literally, you know, being kind of booted out on their own to not only deal with being sick, but now trying to obtain health care into the U.S. system?
Yeah, which I think was pointed out pretty well by Michael Moore on Sicko. Wasn't that easy for the first responders, again, at 9/11?
Right, right.
So, well, best of luck to those men and women and that responded to help. And, you know, the poor victims in Japan, it's not their fault either. Here the U.S. service people go, the Navy goes, they want to help these people. The poor Japanese people who become instant refugees, they're getting help in you know, folks who wouldn't be in harm's way are now in harm's way because of the nuclear power plant. And so you've got a whole pile of victims on the Japanese side. You've got a whole pile of victims now from the people who are trying to help them. And what's still nothing happening to TEPCO? Still nothing happening to the owners? They're just going to go belly up and that'll be the end of it? Nobody's going to go to jail?
From what we've seen so far, the federal prosecutors in Japan have indicated they are not going to pursue criminal charges. And, of course, this is not sitting well with a lot of people. And it's really frustrating for us to see, too, because, you know, there's so much obvious negligence that went on. And they're not pursuing any criminal charges. TEPCO as a company, you know, is kind of slowly getting themselves back into a corner. And we're seeing more and more efforts of the government, you know, either taking over or taking more of a directive role in what's going on at the plant and with the response. And TEPCO's running out of money.
Yeah, I'm surprised they've got any left.
Well, the major lending banks in Japan this week said that after this last round of loans in December, they're not going to issue any additional credit to TEPCO.
Does TEPCO, are all the nuclear power plants still shut down in Japan?
Yes.
So they're not making money from any of their other plants either.
Right.
Huh. What's up with the water, the contamination? Give us a wellness check on the Pacific outside of the Fukushima Prefecture, and then also what's happening with the containment chambers and stuff at the nuclear power plant itself.
They're still working on trying to stop the leak that's running into the Pacific. And it's kind of a slow process. They're putting in these impermeable walls and then seeing where levels go up and down. In the last week or so, they have seen a little bit of a waning in when they're testing fish in the area. Have kind of gone down a little bit. So we're hoping that continues to be a sign that maybe they're making some progress on stemming the leaks that are going into the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a while before they know for sure, you know, if this is really working or to what extent it is. So that's kind of some hopeful news. There's been a lot of people concerned about contamination in the Pacific, and that's remained kind of an unknown. The U.S. government has said, you know, we don't think there's going to be a problem, so we're not going to do any testing, which has kind of become a circular argument. As they think, we don't think there's a problem, so we're not going to look and make sure. Woods Hole Institute has said in the last week or so that They're looking at doing some citizen-based testing where people can send in specific water samples and get them tested. So the communities along the coast could send in samples to see if they are seeing rises in contamination in the water levels on the shore. And that's some of the first, real action we've seen as far as doing anything comprehensive. And they're doing it as a citizen-based effort because the government has completely said they're not going to fund anything. They won't even give Woods Hole money to do this research.
They won't do what?
They won't give Woods Hole Institute
Cape. Yeah.
Right. Huh. And they've been doing work over on the Pacific side since the disaster. They've made a couple of trips over there and done some analysis work. They've gotten grant money. But they were trying to get the federal government to give either them some money or, employ NOAA or something, anybody to go do some testing. And everywhere they went, they just got turned out.
Hmm. Now, this is horrible for the nation of Japan, but how horrible is it for everybody around them? I mean, how horrible is it for other Pacific Island nations or...
For the most part, the concern is with fishing. Countries like South Korea and China do fish in some of these waters off of Japan that have been impacted. South Korea has put some bans on Japanese fish. They've also made some restrictions on where their fleets can fish, trying to avoid bringing back anything that's contaminated. China and Hong Kong have both had some restrictions on fish, but it was mostly fish coming from Japan. And I think they've handled whatever concerns they had internally with their own fishing fleet that way. There's still a lot of regular food bans between the countries in Asia where some of them are just not letting anything come in from Japan or only certain limited foods can come in or they test heavily before they allow them into their own markets.
Mm-hmm. So that's going to make it but that's not good to have a food shortage, which is a potential then.
There hasn't been as much of an issue about a food shortage per se because Japan isn't a huge exporter.
Mm-hmm.
They're more of an exporter of more unique foods, gourmet foods, unusual foods, things like that, as opposed to large volumes of staples. So it hasn't really put a pinch on any other country's, food sources. And this has become a problem for Japan because nobody's really dependent heavily on their food, on importing, foods from Japan. They're losing a lot of their export business.
Hmm. It just, obviously this is an example of how much is impacted when something like this happens. Is there anybody talking about, we're still building two new nuclear power plants in the United States. Is the nuclear industry in any kind of trouble?
Well, they've been in trouble since before this happened, and the Fukushima disaster isn't helping matters. The budgetary issues with the U.S. government where they're not wanting to spend money on anything ends up kind of impacting all of this too, because if they're not spending money, they're not, giving loan guarantees and they're not, throwing cash around. So where a lot of these companies were kind of dependent on that at one point. The plants that are in process of being built, are having their own struggles, of course, between going over budget and having equipment go wrong. But these are things that a lot of the activists in the no-nukes community have predicted were going to happen. They're building the first of these designs in the United States, and they're kind of learning how as they go. There have been a number of projects that were up in the air that have been canceled in the last 6 months. Different reactor projects that were more on paper than, really a going deal. A lot of those have been scrapped. So there's been a lot of contraction in the industry.
And then, I was just reading Bill McKibben's article in the Rolling Stone today about how the United States now has become, by the time President Obama leaves office, we will be the number one exporter, producer and exporter of oil, beating Saudi Arabia, which flabbergasts me, right? I mean, it's just amazing. It doesn't seem as though we are looking to solutions that, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, in the long run or the short run, are actually even better than nuclear power.
Well, it's sort of frustrating to look at what other countries are doing and see what the United States is doing, and we really don't have a real leadership and energy. It's kind of a free-for-all, where the corporate interests are kind of picking and choosing what they want to do and calling that an energy policy, rather than having something that's focused as, you know, we as a nation need to do this, you know, for our own good. You know, to set a policy that makes sense. You know, what are we going to use as our energy sources and why are we using them? There really isn't one. And then you can look at countries like Germany who have a national policy that's, you know, based on what's going to be really good for the country. And that includes both the people and for the businesses in the country. But they're looking at it from solely a, you know, what makes sense issue rather than, you know, what lobbyists is going to tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't think we're ever going to get away from what lobbyists is going to tell us what to do in the United States, at least not under our current political system. You know, it's,
yep.
I hate to be all doom and gloom on that, but it's just not going to happen.
And the best solution may be for everybody to put solar panels on their house.
Exactly. I mean, there are, when you go out west now, you see the backyard oil pump, and that doesn't even seem to stagger people. So I'd much rather have a solar panel. And then the other thing I noticed when I was traveling in the Midwest a couple of times this year is the really hot states have carports. So there will be public carports that have a roof, you know, to shade the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they have solar panels?
Oh, there's quite a bit of those where they've put these carport roofs over parking lots. And the roof of them is the solar panels. I think University of Michigan has one somewhere on their campus, and I've seen a couple of museums have put them in. And it makes sense. It's, you know, it's a double bonus. You have, you know, basically free power, and then your car's not getting hot.
Yeah. It's a brilliant idea, but it needs to be more. It needs to be everywhere that they do that stuff out there, because they seem to be doing it literally everywhere. Well, Nancy, as always, it's wonderful to chat with you about this stuff. I wish that there was happier news. Do you have big holiday plans?
No, probably just going to relax and be glad I'm not working for a day.
Yeah, no kidding. This is our last live show for the rest of the year, so you have a happy new year.
And happy new year to you guys.
Yeah, we'll check up with you in 2014. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Region 1C Director Norwood Jewell says the United Auto Workers Union wants to end the two-tier wage system at the Detroit 3. That system pays some new hires much less than veteran UAW members at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. Jewell told reporters in Flint, Michigan that the UAW hates the two-tier system and will work to get rid of it. New hires under the two-tier system now hire in at just under $16 an hour. That wage can rise to $19 over time, while veteran UAW members make about $28 an hour. Roughly 16% of GM's 51,000 UAW members make that lower wage. At Ford, it's about 19%, and at Chrysler, it's close to 25%. The UAW will be in contract talks with the Detroit 3 in 2015. Nancy Becker is an American working for Amazon in Germany. She traveled to Seattle recently to dare Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to try working as a picker in an Amazon warehouse for just a single week. She doesn't think he could survive it because the work is physically demanding and wages are low. These workers, known as pickers, pick out the merchandise ordered by Amazon customers for shipment. Amazon workers in Germany have been striking over the low pay and working conditions. Nancy Becker came to Seattle, Amazon's world headquarters, to participate in rallies driving home the point that while Bezos' other executives
executives and Amazon shareholders are getting rich, Amazon workers are suffering. Becker says the Amazon system is characterized by low wages and permanent performance pressures. The National Institute on Retirement Security says blacks and Latinos in the United States own shockingly little assets for their retirements. In a recent report, the Institute says 62% of black American workers and 69% of Latino workers own no assets in retirement accounts. The report also notes that 3 out of 4 black households and 4 out of 5 Latino households, ages 25 to 64, have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. 1 out of 2 white households have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. In a different study, the Economic Policy Institute found that the American retirement system simply doesn't work for most workers and underscores the importance of preserving and strengthening Social Security and also defending the remaining defined benefit private pensions.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. We deserve more. We're worth more.
McDonald's is making $5.5 billion off of profits last year. Arby's made $1.5 billion off of profits last year. So why is we getting all these low minimum wage jobs? We sit up in a poor neighborhood trying to survive. Enough is enough. We're tired. It's time to rise up.
Keep the voices of workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day. Support Workers Independent News right now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show. I got no
last half hour of the 2013 season of the Rick Smith Show live season. We have encore performances going to be playing now until the new year of our People's Tour, so tune in for that. You'll hear some really amazing, incredible folks talk about the history of the rise and now, sadly, the fall of the middle class in the United States of America. But right now, we're going to go to Talk Radio News, as we do every night at this time. And Justin Duckham's with us. Hey, Justin, how are you?
Good, good. How are you doing, Pat?
I'm doing just great. So we've got NSA. First of all, I know the answer is not the answer I want, but if they legalize dope, then they let the people in jail for using dope out. You know, that was the first thing that happened in Colorado when they legalized it was, bam, all these people who had charges against them, the charges were dropped, right? Hundreds and hundreds of cases. Okay, so now the NSA is naughty. Everybody agrees the NSA is naughty, and the judge says they're naughty, and we've still got Edward Snowden hanging out in, Putinville.
That's certainly true. Of course, we saw today that the president is becoming, increasingly isolated on this issue. He is facing a barrage of criticism from some high-ranking members of the Senate. He, of course, yesterday had that ruling from a district judge who said that these practices were not constitutional. And, of course, today we had his hand-selected panel that was chosen by the administration to sort of be watchdogs coming forward with a report that essentially said not to do exactly what the administration was doing, which is to, of course, not collect wide ranges of metadata without a court order, and to not keep them in a public setting. So, I'm not sure how this is going to affect Mr. Snowden, but it does certainly look like the winds are changing in public opinion. And if he ever does come home, he may not be facing the traitor's welcome he was probably expecting.
Well, I think it would be really personally, my feelings are obviously quite frank about the fact that I think it's an absolute travesty that he's in trouble. I feel the same way about Chelsea Manning. And this whole NSA thing has blown up on my Facebook page to a point where I have now been accused. I mean, honestly, no one would steal my identity. No one would pretend to be me. I have the most safe identity in the world because I have my mother told me once, you should just go out and find a third and neutral name you've never used before and try that one. But I was accused today because I was defending, individual liberty of sympathizing with terrorism. And who are these American, quote-unquote, red-blooded Americans? I've got to turn around and say, I think you're trying to trap me. You're trying to get me to say something, you creep. Like, all these people are just like, no, we need to know all of this. And I said, do you care how much money has been spent doing this? I mean, first of all, metadata, they, according to these people, does nobody any good. It's, they can't be used for anything. And I'm like, okay, so why are we spending money on it? This wasn't...
That's a very good question. Of course, the entire idea that you may be supporting the terrorists has sort of gone out the window now that, you know, when up against the federal judge, the administration did not produce any evidence that these massive data collection techniques actually resulted in the prevention of any attacks. So, you know, that is sort of evidence right there that you are not supporting anybody except for, you know, those who I guess would believe in the Fourth Amendment.
Yay! And, you know, there's only one amendment. Well, thank you, thank you. There's only one amendment that matters anymore. It's the second one. The second one is the only one people are willing to fight for.
That's what it seems like sometimes.
Yeah, it absolutely blows my mind. Okay, so other things are happening all across our fair land. The Senate has passed the budget, so the budget's now winding its way to the president. And who cares? It's over, right?
Exactly. This was, you know, yesterday it passed on a procedural vote, getting 7 more votes than needed to overcome the filibuster, and today it sailed through the Senate with equal ease. We ended up getting a 64-36 vote. It looks like the government now, as soon as this bill is signed, which is, of course, going to happen, will be funded through 2015, and the threat of a shutdown in 2014 or before then, sometime next year, is now off the table, which is welcome news for those who are really, you know, frustrated with the sort of apex that Congress had reached.
Except
in terms of responsibility.
There's still a possibility for the debt ceiling shutdown, right?
Well, yeah, there's that too. There's still, you know, massive economic chaos that could be, you know, screwing through there. And, of course, we're seeing Republicans coming out with, you know, their list of demands that they're going to require in order to raise the debt ceiling. So way to be a killjoy. We are having a happy bipartisan moment over here in D.C., and you had to come in and ruin it. Thanks a lot. Merry
Christmas.
Yeah,
really. Hey, guess what? Santa's black.
OMG. Actually, no, I was reading, like, I guess Santa Claus actually originated in Turkey, so, yeah, I guess Santa is a old Turkish guy.
And that would be great. I mean, they have great coffee.
They certainly do. I love Turkish delight. You know, Turkish bathhouses, you know, great country, great people.
Wonderful, wonderful bread. Amazing stuff, yeah. Okay, so Bacchus?
Yeah, this was something that really came as a surprise to quite a few people today. Bacchus, you know, it was revealed that the administration has, in fact, been talking to Bacchus, and it looks like Max Bacchus from Montana, who is a moderate Democratic senator, is going to be named as the next ambassador to China. You know, he was somebody who said that he was going to be retiring from the Senate. Everyone kind of presumed he would just be either fading into oblivion or taking a very lucrative lobbyist position with a number of healthcare companies or banking institutions, since he has had such a huge legislative presence when it comes to those issues.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it's just a major surprise, and it looks like he's going to be representing the U.S. interests abroad in what was really just kind of a surprising, WTS-like announcement.
Yeah. He wasn't going to run for Senate again anyway, right?
No, he was not. He was going to be retiring at the end of his term.
And how do the Chinese feel about this? Any?
I had this number written down earlier for the amount of times that he has traveled to China in his capacity as a senator. I know it was an impressive number. So I think he's probably more than qualified for the position. He's going to have most likely a very easy vote in the Senate, which, of course, was an institution that he has served in since 1978 or 1976. So I don't foresee it really being an issue for him. How the Chinese are going to interpret it, I don't know. But, you know, of course, this is a very important position considering all of the political and economic issues related to that country.
And the way that they interface with North Korea, for us, not for us, whatever that says. Okay, so now I'm going to test your knowledge of pop culture.
Oh, my.
Unfairly. I apologize for doing this on a surprise, but I can't remember the name. Wasn't the last ambassador to China the dude from House who also played in that movie about the airbender or something.
Oh, you're talking about the actor who was in those movies, Harold and Kumar, that guy?
Yeah.
No. He served in the administration, but he was not the ambassador to China.
Oh, okay.
The last one we had was, I'm blanking on his name. He was the former commerce secretary. And prior to that, of course, we had John Huntsman, who was a 2012 flop.
That's right. Good going on the dude from House, though.
I'm blanking on his name, though. Like, I feel like I should know this offhand.
Yeah, wow. And what was that, The Last Airbender or something? Which was actually
The Last Airbender. I think he was in that.
He was the villain.
Yeah, but no, I know for a fact he was in the three Harold and Kumar movies.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Okay, so, and then one other quick question. I don't want to keep you too long, but I am always impressed by people like that Steve King dude. And, you know, I used to work for Stephen King, the scary novel guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never been real happy about this Steve King representative. For good reason.
How's he not?
Yeah, I mean, you Google the two and, you know, it's awful when the other guy's name comes up. But, you know, he's pro-dog fighting.
Stephen King, the novelist or the representative?
No, the representative.
Well, I was going to say, if it was a novelist, then Cujo takes on a whole different meaning.
True that. He wants all the only scary dogs to be in his books. He doesn't need the competition. But,
there we go.
But no,
Pet Cemetery too, I guess. You know?
Yeah, that's right, Pet Cemetery. They really don't do well, and then they do worse. But the Steve King guy, right, he's pro dog fights and all kinds of nasty. He's just a nasty human being. But this representative, Jack Kingston now, the Republican from Georgia, wants kids who have to get lunch in school to work for it?
Yeah, no, I saw that. He apparently believes that they have to participate in cleaning their school, which is really just kind of a tragedy. There's already such a stigma going on with the benefits that underprivileged children have.
Yeah.
That, of course, a lot of them will try to hide the fact that they are, trying to receive those lunches. And it's really just putting lemon in the wounds by making them do this and also punishing the kids for something that is absolutely beyond their control, I'd like to imagine I was the reason behind my parents' success, but I realistically know I probably didn't have much to do with it and probably hindered it.
You're really fun. The other thing, I think you make a great point, and then when the kids hide the fact or even don't even accept public lunch anymore, they're going to say they're doing it because they're lazy, when the reason they're really doing it is because they're humiliated.
Exactly. I mean, high school is a bitter place. I'm a fat guy, so I can attest to that personally. I think I would probably just be putting the kids in a, very dangerous health situation, and also it would be creating some very disturbing ethical questions. You're forcing children to pay for something that's publicly subsidized and, not getting, money through the school. So you'd have sort of a weird slave labor-like class. Who knows?
These guys are like mainlining bitter evil juice or something.
This is why I've never read Ayn Rand, just because I'm terrified that if I read it, I'll become like one of these guys. I have to self-censor myself sometimes.
We were all talking about Steinbeck the other day, and someone unwelcome to the conversation said, "Well, you guys ought to read a little Ayn Rand." I'm like, what?
Mm.
Yeah, I don't think so. And this guy's not rich. You know, that's the other thing is these are like the screws in the jailhouse, who rat out their fellow inmates just to get an extra crust of bread.
Yeah. No, but at this point, we've heard so much outrageous Tea Party rhetoric in the past, 5-6 years, that this doesn't really faze me anymore.
Do you think they do this? They know they're not going to make the kids do this, but they do this so that a whole pile of angry white guys scratching their hairy stuff will say, "Oh yeah, he's my kind of guy."
Well, I think that's very apparent. I mean, I think most of the legislation that they put forward, they know there's no chance in doing. And I think everybody just wants to sort of be the new conservative hero, maybe take up a lucrative, speaking position with a think tank a la Jim DeMint, maybe become the next Sarah Palin and get some nice Fox News cash. Less cynically, just to rally the base in their own districts so we don't get a Republican primary challenger more from the right. But, you know, either way, it's absolutely inexcusable, especially when you're, you know, proposing stuff like this, which is, you know, frankly, harmful to kids.
Yeah, that's sad. It's sad to think that our children have been marginalized, and kids have always been used, you know, always. But to be used in such a self-serving and selfish fashion as to do, you know, to throw around a threat like that to children. I used to live in the Netherlands. I went to graduate school there. And I took my kids with me. I was a single mom, and I had a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old when I first enrolled in graduate school. And when you go to the Netherlands, you get a child benefit. And it doesn't matter if you make $1 million a year or you make $25,000 a year. You get a child benefit. And so everybody cashes their child benefit check. You know, there's no stigma. And then if you make $1 million a year, you're paying 50% income tax. So they're getting it back. They're getting back their $480 a month or whatever it was, you know. But it was just such a fair, equalizing, you know, way of handling, hey, gee, you know, people might be struggling to make ends meet when they have kids, you know. It's amazing. Anyway,
well,
Justin,
I hope you enjoy your socialist Christmas.
I certainly intend to. I intend to redistribute my meager wealth to my kids, and I'm very excited about it.
There we go.
Justin, have a great holiday and a happy new year. And everybody from the Rick Smith Show says happy holidays to all you folks over there at Talk Radio News.
Well, thank you so much. You have a good one as well.
Okay. Take care. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be right back.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats, specifically by an inside-the-beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout. Only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You'll see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
How can we be a people that fight for America if we don't know who America is or what we're all about? This is, in my opinion, a conscious effort on the part of the left, who has a huge influence on our curriculum, to desensitize America to what American values are, so they're more pliable to the new values that they would like to impose on America.
Hey, Brett, who's that whack job? That's Rick Santorum. Yeah, we want new values, Rick. You know what your last name means now, right? I'm Pat LaMarche, by the way, filling in for Rick Smith, who's gone to Florida with his lovely family for the holidays. The new values we want are we want to avoid our old values of racism, genocide, enslaving people, misogyny, sexism. We want new values. You're right. You're on to us. Rick Santorum, a genius, ahead of his time. Hey, we've got like, 10 minutes left in our last program of 2013. And, you know, if you want to take 5 minutes, no, you don't have five. 2 minutes and wish everybody a happy holiday, 888-520-7425. 888-520-7425. 520-Rick. Yeah, we'll throw you on the radio for a few seconds if you want to wish a happy holiday. In the meantime, the year in review, that's what you always do, right? What was 2013 really like? It was a big change for me. It was about a year ago last December that I moved back down to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, a place I love, transplanted myself to a number of years ago to work at Safe Harbor Homeless Shelter and work with the homeless here in the area and work with the Salvation Army. And I just loved the place. Had an opportunity to go up and work with Stephen King for a while, launched a progressive morning show for him and a little radio network up there. Just missed Carlisle and really wanted to do some crazy things like travel the country and meet people and see what it's like on the ground to be an average person. You know, I'm an average person, but I kind of was stuck in, you know, average person Maine or average person New England or average person Pennsylvania. We get a chance to really do some touring and see what it's like for the homeless all across the United States. I then get to travel with Brett and Rick and Carol and the kids on our People's Tour and really got to interview an incredible number of wonderful people who knew a lot about history, a lot about labor unions. My mom was a union member. Everybody in my family practically was. If it hadn't been for union wages, half of us wouldn't have had the educations that we had. But personally, I never have been. And so it was really quite an eye-opener. I remember my mom getting so angry when they'd be turned out of work. And she was a tough, hard-working woman, and so many of these people that we met on our trip were, and it was really an honor. And it was fun to do fun things like walk across the Golden Gate Bridge, and we did some great things with the kids, spent 3 hours at the Grand Canyon, 45 minutes at the Hoover Dam. It was the craziest speed trip of all time. And the hardest I've ever worked. I mean, I didn't work half that hard when I ran for vice president, making a show every night. Brett, our producer, did the yeoman's task of pulling all that audio together and making a show for us. And Rick and I host, anchored them together. It was just really fun. And I'm grateful for 2013. I hope you are too. I hope that, you have a prosperous, wonderful, happy 2014. I hope that 2014 sees a whole pile of governors packing their bags and moving out of governor mansions. And I hope that the governors that move in respect the fact that the taxpayers pay for their transportation, the taxpayers pay for their health care, the taxpayers pay for their everything, pay their salaries, and do not begrudge equal care for the people of the state. When I would get on the bus to ride to Harrisburg and see the signs that, implored Governor Corbett not to eliminate public transportation, it's like, what are you even thinking? You have public transportation. Your driver and your car, they're paid for by the taxpayers. Your transportation's public. How dare you? Well, it's way too many governors like that, and so 2014, hopefully we'll see those guys turned out. And it would be interesting to see what happens to Congress. It would be interesting to see the Democrats go back where they belong and the Republicans, you know. You used to be the Party of Liberty, remember? Maybe you remember Abraham Lincoln. Anyway, a couple of quick news stories on our way out. There's a story by Bill McKibben, and it's in the current issue of Rolling Stone. I'll just read you one brief part of it. I think it's very important, and I think that we as the left have to continue to put pressure on President Obama. This is from Bill McKibben's story in Rolling Stone. If you want to understand how people remember the Obama climate legacy, a few facts tell the tale. By the time President Obama, he just says Obama, but I kind of insist on calling him president. By the time President Obama leaves office, the United States will pass Saudi Arabia as the planet's biggest oil producer and Russia as the world's biggest producer of oil and gas combined. We're going to be the biggest producer of oil and gas combined before President Obama leaves. In the same years, even as we've begun to burn less coal at home, our coal exports have climbed to record highs. We are, despite slight declines in our domestic emissions, a global warming machine. At the moment when physics tells us we should be jamming on carbon brakes, America is revving up the engine. You know, it was President Obama who promised that things were going to go in the other direction, and it's just not happened. And it's quite alarming that it has not happened. You could argue that private industry, not the White House, has driven the boom. And in part, you would be right. But that's not what President Obama himself would say. Here is President Obama speaking in Cushing, Oklahoma last year in a speech that historians will quote many generations hence. It is to energy what Mitt Romney's secretly taped talk about the 47% was to inequality. This is what President Obama said. Over the last 3 years, I've directed my administration to open up millions of acres for gas and oil exploration across 23 different states. We're opening up more than 75% of our potential oil resources offshore. We've quadrupled the number of operating rigs to a record high. We've added enough new oil and gas pipeline to encircle the earth. And then some, in fact, the problem is that we're actually producing so much oil and gas that we don't have enough pipeline capacity to transport it where it needs to go. That's the Democrat in the White House. That's what he's doing. And that's a problem. Another story that I'll bring to your attention, and if you have time, you can go to the website or go to the Facebook page. I'll post it there. Real interesting story from Mother Jones. Should the National Football League be a not-for-profit organization? Are you kidding me? Why in the world is the NFL not-for-profit? I also don't think that hospitals should be not-for-profit. No, there is a not-for-profit hospital that pays its CEO $5.6 million a year. That's just the CEO's salary. Because that hospital is not-for-profit, it doesn't pay any property taxes. The taxes that should be paid by that hospital, paying $6 million a year effectively to its CEO, are paid by taxpayers who don't have health care. It's just ridiculous. Then we get to the NFL. Overall revenues are up $9 billion. The NFL is the most lucrative sports league on the planet. Roger Goodall, who's the NFL commissioner, says he would like to triple the league's revenues to $25 billion by the year 2027. $25 billion. They want to make $25 billion. People who play football and their owners, especially the owners. The NFL pays nothing in taxes on those revenues. Absolutely nothing, not a nickel. And why is that? They are not for profit. There is an organization called Root Strikers. Root Strikers are urging people to email and sign a petition in support of Senator Tom Coburn's. This is a Republican pro sports act that would ban big sports leagues from receiving tax exempt status. Yay. I wonder if the rest of the Republican Party knows. Remember when they asked Mitt Romney in the 2012 when he was running for president if he knew any football, liked football, and he said, no, but I know a few owners. Anyway, that music says it's over for us for 2013. We'll see you next year. Have a wonderful holiday and a great new year.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming.